Morning, everyone. The Senate Education Committee will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 11, 2015. It's 8 a.m. We're in room 112 at the State Capitol. We have several bills before us today. We'll start with Senate File 1276. We welcome Senator Pappas and invite your testifiers to join you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Chairman, I know are probably familiar with St. Paul Promise Neighborhood in the Northside Achievement Zone. You've given those projects, those models and pilots some strong support in the past. Now the proposal before you is to take those models and pilots with their promising and very successful results into greater Minnesota to different neighborhoods throughout the state. The important thing with to stress with Senate File 1276 is the flexibility in the legislation based on the local needs while still kind of respecting the research-based programmatic elements of the original pilots. And this proposal does include three tiers, so grants for communities to do planning, grants for the projects that are already in development and would be more like the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, and grants that have been in implementation to continue the work they've been doing, like the Northside Achievement Zone. I understand we have very little time before you, so I wanted to just give those introductory comments. We have some handouts in your package that provide some data on the existing programs and how they are develop the wraparound services for the students. And to give you some idea of the success, I have with me testifiers here this morning. And so let's turn first to Maureen Ramirez from Growth and Justice.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Welcome, Ms. Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. I'm the Policy and Research Director at Growth and Justice. And I'm here this morning to introduce the coalition supporting the Educational Partnerships Fund. We're a statewide coalition of urban and rural educational partnerships here supporting each other and requesting the state's investment in comprehensive community efforts to reduce achievement and opportunity gaps. Our coalition members are working across the state in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Red Wing, Northfield, St. Cloud, and other cities establishing cross-sector data-driven approaches to increasing student success and eliminating poverty. These educational partnerships, though they vary according to their location, size, and scope, share a few characteristics I'll review now, and then we'll hear from them a few examples. Our partnerships take a holistic approach to students, families, and community development. By aligning, coordinating, and providing services to families, the partnerships are integrating programs and removing barriers across sectors and agencies to maximize efficiency. We know when we can do the work of aligning and coordinating efforts, we multiply our impact. These partnerships focus on continuous support, often called wraparound services, for children and their families with great schools at the center. We are results-driven. Each partnership tracks key indicators to measure, monitor, and evaluate their outcomes to refocus on what's working, on closing achievement and opportunity gaps. They have a strong commitment to accountability and transparency in their outcomes. You can also see on your handout the focus for these partnerships is human capital and workforce talent development. Multiple partners are working together in each partnership, including education leaders, community institutions, business leaders, and local chambers of commerce, as well as local government, philanthropy, health, and faith leaders. We're pleased now to share with you three communities, two that are Promise Neighborhoods and one that is a Strive community. What you'll see is the range of work being done at the local level across Minnesota to advance student success, reduce poverty, and close opportunity gaps.
Thank you.
Then we have Ms. Sondra Samuels from the Northside Achievement Zone.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Sondra Samuels. I'm president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone. You may have read Saturday in the paper that a St. Paul man, age 35, was shot in North Minneapolis, Northeast Minneapolis, and died. Well, he wasn't simply a St. Paul man. He actually lived in the zone in North Minneapolis. And though he had challenges, he was a father who cared for his children, a married man, showed up at school, and our staff knew him well because we know his children. And his children are part of the zone. They're part of Minneapolis Public Schools. And we know that they're going to have challenges, and we expect them to show up to learn. And I've been living in the zone for 18 years now, and I got to tell you, I have a lot of hope that they will be okay. And I believe that they'll be okay because this isn't the first time this kind of thing has happened in our community. But we finally have a plan. And our plan is innovative, and it's been turning things around in our state's, arguably our state's toughest neighborhood. North Minneapolis is ground zero for the state in terms of all the disparities around education, opportunity, and income. We have 5,500 children living in the community and who all want to do well, graduate from college, and live the lives that many of us are living here. At NAS, we believe that a total commitment to education has the power to change not only the culture of our neighborhood, but also the educational and statewide outcomes for a more equitable and prosperous Minnesota. We have a game-changing approach that's closing the achievement gap. The approach has three elements. One, we believe family is the unit of change. We target the hardest-to-reach parents who have not traditionally been involved in promoting academic success in the community, but they sure are now. Today, we have 740 families. Our goal is 1,000 by the end of the year, 1,700 scholars, and we want 2,500 by the end of the year. And the families have really stepped up and taken charge in dramatic ways. We are surrounding each family with community support, all the support that's available. Like the other communities you'll hear from, we have multiple agencies and organizations that have been trying to help, each in our own way. But we have formalized a collaborative partnership with 39 schools and agencies to serve our families and the community. In addition to the educational partnerships, we support families with health, housing, jobs, whatever it takes for them to be successful and keep their children on track. And lastly, we are high touch and high tech. Through NAS Connect, our online family achievement and planning process, we can track our data constantly, make sure our students are on point through our system, and hold everybody accountable. Our approach is working. More of our children are showing up kindergarten ready than those who are not in our pipeline, half of the children as opposed to 35%. More are getting on track in terms of third grade reading. More parents are moving into jobs and are more hopeful, and I could go on. And I want to close by saying this is a targeted investment. We have assured, a return on investment. A study was done by Wilder Research that found that for every dollar that's invested in NAS, there would be a $6 societal return in the forms of savings and earnings because of increased earnings from high school graduates, improved health, taxes paid, and reduced dependency. We believe that our long-term sustainability will be built on evidence of effectiveness, which we are showing, both in personal terms for families and students and in economic terms for the community and our state as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now from the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, we have Manir Karcheramos.
Welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Munir Karcheramos, and I'm the director of the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. The St. Paul Promise neighborhood uses education as a tool to end multi-generational poverty in the Frogtown and Summit University neighborhoods of St. Paul. Today, I really want to say St. Paul Promise neighborhood is focused on results. We are aligned directly with the Education Partner Fund's collective goals around all children are ready for school, all third graders can read at grade level. We're looking to close the racial and economic achievement gaps between students. All students are ready for college and career, and all students graduate from high school. If we speak directly to our results, around our kindergarten readiness goal, we've had about 350 students who have received Race to the Top early learning scholarships. And of those children, according to our measurements, we've had 74% who are ready for kindergarten compared to 60% across the state and 29% across the rest of the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. If we look at our reading benchmarks by the end of third grade, according to the MCAs, as we've seen an 8% increase at Jackson, a 4% increase at Maxfield, and a 3% increase at St. Paul City School. So what we're really creating here is school-level change that's going to create a tipping point in our neighborhood of achievement and success. You know, this is compared to these 8% at Jackson, 4% at Maxfield, and 3% at St. Paul City School. It's compared to just under 1% improvement in the St. Paul public schools and just over 1% at the across the state of Minnesota. So we're looking at, you know, between 3 to 8 times better growth at within our schools, because we're really figuring out how do we wrap around our kids the things that they need and their families, such as housing. So we're looking at these holistic supports. When we talk about housing, we're not just looking at housing in and of itself, but really looking at that relationship between how does housing stability affect school attendance. Of our families who've been housed, which have been about 50, over half of the kids in those houses were chronically absent. This year, none of those children are chronically absent. These are the children who often, but not always, were, you know, part of contributing to the achievement gap. But we're seeing that the kids are aligned and doing better with what's happening, you know, in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. Another piece of what we're working on is really looking at how do we coordinate our approach. And we really have this localized approach, which is, which you'll hear lifted up in Northside Achievement Zone and Northfield later today, or in a second. And it's these localized approaches that we believe the Education Partnership Fund will really get at. It's tailoring a local approach so that everyone's getting great results, so that what we see here happening in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood and the results are being delivered can also be expanded elsewhere throughout the state. I sit here in front of you today asking you to also support this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And finally, we have Zach Pruitt from Northfield Promise.
Thank you, Welcome. Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Zach Pruitt, and I'm the director of Northfield Promise. Thank you, Muneer and Sandra, for your work with the Promise Neighborhoods. I'm here to tell you about another educational partnership model, the STRIVE model, that we use in Northfield. As a member of the STRIVE Together Network, Northfield Promise is taking nationally recognized best practices and adapting them to our local community. Northfield Promise connects and aligns resources, programs, and community members to collaborate towards measurable results around 10 critical benchmarks. These range from kindergarten readiness to third grade reading to having a connection with a caring adult during middle school to graduating from high school with a plan for the future. More than 500 people in 50 groups are already actively engaged in Northfield Promise. We have action teams forming around our 10 benchmarks that are looking at local data, mapping existing community efforts, studying best practices, and designing collaborative solutions. Although we are still early in our initiative, we have found that when we invite new members into the conversation, new ideas and opportunities emerge. For instance, the local hospital starts talking about how nurses can help promote early literacy and connect families to early childhood programs, or local business owners explore the creation of youth internship opportunities. Northfield Promise is data-driven. Our team of local data and evaluation experts work with our action teams to assess current efforts, what is working, where there are gaps, and where there are changes needed. This ongoing commitment to continuous improvement is key to our success. Finally, as a STRIVE partner, we commit to transparency. This is a community-owned initiative, and the community has a right to hear how it is going. We recently mailed our first community report to every household in the school district, which I believe is in your packet. We commit to releasing this annually so that there is a clear level of community accountability in this work. In closing, the energy around the STRIVE effort and the initial gains that we are seeing in Minnesota communities like Red Wing, Grand Rapids, St. Cloud, the Twin Cities, and Austin are generating national attention. The opportunity for the state to target its investments to local initiatives that are closing the achievement and opportunity gaps with a commitment to data-driven outcomes is critical. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have that's all we have. Anyone has any questions? I think the important thing, what we're seeing with these projects is services to students are no longer siloed. It's not like some people get help with housing, some people get after school work, some people get health assistance. It's all of the above. If that's what the student needs, then the community partners are there for them.
Thank you. Senator Pappas, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Zach, and Senator Pappas. I appreciate Zach. A welcome addition to our community, and he does great work for all of the reasons that he spelled out here. And we often think of the need is so great in our urban areas or really economically depressed areas. But, Zach, could you maybe just share what were some of the things that you saw happening in Northfield, which is this idyllic little community south of us. What kind of things were you seeing that says we really need to, as a community, come together with all these partners to, what were some of the issues or problems that you were seeing?
Ms. Pruitt.
Sure, thank you. I think one of, as with communities across the state, I think Northfield is not immune from an achievement and opportunity gap. Low-income students, unfortunately, in our school are not yet performing at a rate that we're, as a community, would be excited about. About 40% of our third graders from low-income homes are not yet reading at proficiency. In math at the sixth grade level, only one in three low-income students is at proficiency. So we, even with the great school systems that we have and the great community resources, I think this has been a call to our community to say we can do better. And collectively, it takes our community working together and all the different sectors coming together to sort of help to change that. And I think one of the most exciting parts about this effort is that it's stopped being seen as just a school issue, but really it is around school and community partners coming together to address some pretty difficult to tackle topics.
Thanks.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 1276? Members, there being an appropriation, this would need to go to finance. Senator Pappas testifiers, you hit all the key benchmarks that we're looking for, measuring to close the achievement gap, ready for K. Graduation, it's all there, and as we look at our budget target, et cetera, I know it'll get very close consideration. There being no further discussion, Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 1276 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. Further discussion, comments? Not all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Carried. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas and testifiers.
I get it.
Next, we'll go to the governor's omnibus policy bill, and I'll ask the commissioner and department staff that will be accompanying her to walk through the articles. And members will take any questions after each article, and then following the article presentations, anyone that would like to testify May. And we have listed so far Jim Bartholomew and Jody Olson. And if there's others, please let us know. And you know, there will be additional opportunity as we roll out the omnibus bill next week, but we will allow some time today to express any concerns. Welcome back, Commissioner Casellas.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you again for having me back. I know I've spent a lot of time in front of the committee this session so far, but there's a lot of good work that we're proposing based on a lot of good work we've been doing over the past 4 years and work still yet to do in order to reach those really two goals that are right there in front of us, which is closing the achievement gap by 50% by 2017 and raising our graduation rates to 90% with no student group below 85%. I'm glad to report and have reported to this committee that we are making progress. But again, there's still a lot of work to do for a lot of our kids, as we just heard from the Northside Achievement Zone, which is also in the governor's recs in the south, the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. So we're supportive of those two programs and thank them for their testimony this morning. We have before you today our policy bill. I don't typically come for the technical policy bill, but because there are a couple of issues in here, I felt that there may be some questions from the committee. I'm here to answer those questions. And what I'd like to do, if it's okay with the chair, is to allow Mr. Huser to go through the policy bill and the technical aspects of it. And then at the end, I will take questions on the testing proposal, as well as two other proposals and any other questions, obviously, from the committee. But the ones that I think will bring some questions for me directly around some of the policy changes are the testing proposal from the governor, and also the one plan that we're trying to kind of consolidate some of the reporting burden for our districts. Part of our No Child Left Behind waiver is to look at and study and reduce burdensome reporting and inefficiencies in reporting. And so this is an attempt to try to consolidate some of that reporting for our districts and also reporting to the legislature so that it's more meaningful for you and your decision-making process.
Thank you, Commissioner, and welcome. And we'll start with Article 1, and if something's technical, non-controversial, note that we will just acknowledge that. Of course, we'll discuss anything as necessary, but focusing more on testing, perhaps, and some of the issues you just mentioned. Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Huser. I'm the Deputy Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Article 1 makes mostly clarifying and technical changes to the general education funding statutes. We do have Dr. Melcher here in case there are some questions or clarifications with the changes here. We do view these as technical, so if it would be okay with you, Mr. Chair, we could probably move past Article 1 unless there are any questions.
Questions on Article 1? And we reserve a right to go back for any members that are still in transit.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Kiffmeyer?
Yes.
Article 1.
On Article 1, there were some things that were stricken and changed, and so could you just give me a quick summary as to the impact of Article 1? I don't have to go through by section, but just a general impact of what these changes mean.
Maybe Dr. Melcher could give a quick run through.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, the changes in here are mostly technical, correcting cross references. We're deleting reference to an obsolete pupil unit definition. There is one change where the department would finalize the tax rate for the student achievement levy on September 30th rather than July 1st, so that we can more accurately arrive at the $20 million, the tax rate that generates $20 million after the revenue department has a little more time to make their corrections. And the rest of the changes here, we're deleting an obsolete levy for health insurance that nobody qualifies for any longer. And we're making some technical corrections in some of the referendum calculations to reflect current practice. There were some errors made in the 2013 legislation, but nothing of substance is changing in Article 1 other than that date going from July 1 to September 30th.
Okay. Article 2.
Sections 1 and 2 of Article 2 are making some changes to the language seals that were passed last session. We have been working with advocates and other stakeholders to further clarify these changes with an amendment. That amendment is not – the language is not quite finished yet, but we'll continue to work with them, and when that's done, we'll make sure to get it in front of the committee.
And if you could just elaborate a little bit, because there may be some heartburn by some on this, and to allay any concerns – you are working with various groups to clarify on these provisions.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are working with some changes with the Act, the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Language Standards, the ACTFL standards. Those have some changes coming. We're trying to make sure that we're going to be consistent with those. We're also working to make sure that the new level certificates and seals that are being created are actually going to align with Minsky credit. So we're working with all the stakeholders to make sure that everybody is on the same page with those changes. Section 3 is related to how students are able to use agricultural science or career and technical education credits to meet science credits. The bill is offering clarifying language that will identify how those credits can meet graduation science requirements by distinguishing between the course content requirements for the chemistry or physics credit compared with the course content for an elective science credit. Section 4 is what is actually happening in this section is that it's deleting a cross-reference, but for ahead in the bill, we will actually be repealing the Education Planning and Assessment System, the EPAS program. Section 5 is the MCA changes to the assessments. The bill eliminates the mathematics MCAs for grades 3 and 4, but would still require it in grades 5 through 8 and grade 11. It eliminates the reading MCAs for grades 6 and 7 and would require it in grades 3 through 5, 8, and 10. It's important to note that these changes would only occur with an amendment to our state's federal No Child Left Behind flexibility waiver. The proposal also eliminates the Grade 8 Explore, Grade 10 Plan, and Compass tests. These tests would no longer be provided by ACT. An amendment will take out the Grade 12 option that was originally in the bill. This may have carried a fiscal impact, and so if we can get if that amendment were to pass, it would eliminate that grade 12 option. There is also some technical restructuring of this in this section as well. Section 6 is
And we will get back on the testing. There's a few other references, then we'll focus more.
Okay. Section 6 is a technical restructuring of the assessment standards. Section 7 is asking MDE to develop a list of circumstances under which a student may be unable to take a test would not be penalized for that missed testing opportunity. Section 8 establishes a composite career and college readiness marks in grades 5 and 8 in high school, which predict performance on a college entrance exam. Section 9 establishes the usage of statewide assessment data by districts and also makes technical restructuring changes. Sorry, Mr. Chair, I lost my place here. Section 10 is technical. Section 11... Thank you. Section 11 is a cross-reference. Section 12 would allow for a 10th grader who is not able to take the 8th grade MCAs to use a different assessment in order to take certain CTE courses. Section 13 is more clearly stating that a middle or early college program must provide for a clearly defined pathway to a degree or a credential. Section 14 is asking that a charter school authorizer must provide notice to the commissioner by July 15th for implementation by June 30th of the next year, regardless of when their five-year term is over.
As long as we're on the testing.
Section 15 changes a new charter school's authorizer affidavit to be filed at least 14 months before July 1st, the year the school plans to serve students. Section 16 allows a charter school to offer a fee-based pre-kindergarten program. We would have included in our amendment, it would add that these students cannot be counted as a pupil unit. Section 17 would allow a charter school, charter schools would be allowed to give a student preference for admission if that student was enrolled in the school's pre-kindergarten program, but if that program must be free. It does clarify that if a charter school establishes an early admissions program to kindergarten, it must be include a process and procedure for the comprehensive evaluation to determine that the child can actually meet the grade expectation. Section 18 applies the special education statutes relating to travel and litigation costs to charter schools. Section 19 allows a charter school to combine its annual public report as part of its world's best workforce report. There will be other sections further on in the bill that do a similar that allow similar reporting for districts. Section 20 provides a process for merging two charter schools. Currently, there is nothing in statute as a guideline for MDE when we are for merging two charter schools. We have had to do this and kind of not necessarily come up with it, but figure out what the best practice would be. These changes came out of that work. Section 21 is some cleanup language from last session's bill relating to the Learning Year program. Section 22 updates the some language for the American Indian Education Act. Section 23 is a technical change naming Tribal Nations Education Committee in statute. It's already in statute, but this would be adding it to another place. Section 24 is some conforming changes to federal law. In this section, in our amendment, we also would be adding that American Indian schools may also participate in professional organizations and associations. Section 25 adds indigenous language as a curriculum consideration. Section 26 allows for American Indian students to be enrolled in all academic and targeted services. Section 27 is a technical change. Section 28 asks the Board of Teaching to consult with the Tribal Nations Education Committee in American Indian language and culture licenses. Section 29 asks that a person with American Indian language and cultural education general teaching license to have a deep knowledge and understanding of American Indian history and culture. Section 30 makes technical changes and removes some obsolete dates. Section 31 directs districts who participate in American Indian programs to involve parent advisory committees. Section 32 makes a technical change in the American Indian Education Statute. It's replacing the word teacher's aide with paraprofessional. It is also stating that participating districts who serve more than 100 American Indian students must have an Indian homeschool liaison. We will have, as part of our amendment, adding the words American Indian. It was unclear in the original bill. Section 33 provides cleanup language to the American Indian Parent Advisory Committee statute. Section 34 makes technical changes pertaining to the parent committees. Section 35 puts more of an emphasis on culturally responsive teaching methods pertaining to the technical assistance for teachers and paraprofessionals in the technical assistance that MDE provides for them. Section 36 makes technical changes. Section 37 eliminates the requirement for charter schools to reserve revenue for teacher development and evaluation revenue program, and that's in keeping with the way that charter schools are currently funded. And Section 38 makes repealers to EPAS, improving graduation rates for emotional behavioral disorder reporting. This is a duplicative report that we are already doing for federal reporting. And it repeals the annual reporting for learning and developmental revenue. And that's Section 2, Chair.
Okay. Members, are there any questions on Article 2 except relating to testing? We're going to focus on that after we've discussed anything else. Any non-testing items in Article 2 that you'd like clarification or comment on? Okay, on the testing,
Senator Pratt,
then Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if there was, we've had quite a bit of discussion around assuring in policy, assuring that students are with effective teachers, that student teachers are with effective teachers. Senator Clausen and Senator Kiffmeyer brought several revisions to college and the schools or concurrent enrollment that I'm not seeing here. And what do you have here specifically addressing student achievement, making sure that we do have effective learning going in the classroom?
Commissioner?
Chair, Senator Pratt, we don't have those recommendations from the committee's bills that are in there are not included in this bill. In terms of this is mostly a technical bill with technical changes, and I think you'll see in our budget bill most of our changes that will increase student achievement.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I appreciate the fact that we are actually streamlining testing, and I know that's been a concern of many of our schools. I understand also the kind of the need to unload, explore, and plan because it's going to disappear anyway. And maybe is it my understanding then that the realignment of the math, reading, and science in those other grades will assure us that the kids are on track by the time they get to the ACT? What I worry about is do we have the proper check marks along the way to make sure that all of a sudden in an 11th grade we're not surprised by some results?
Commissioner, and I was going to wait on testing until if you could hold on that, Commissioner. I believe we have one question from Senator Johnson, then we'll go into testing.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, whoever, I'm questioning about the pre-kindergarten fee-based program for charter schools, and I'm wondering if you would just expand a little bit on that. My question is really if the bill passes through with the four-year-old funding that the governor has proposed, would they still be able to offer a fee-based program?
What page?
I just looked at it. Article 16, Section 16, Article 2, page 20.
I can answer that.
29.
Commissioner Excellius on Article 2, Section 16.
Mr. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if the governor's four-year-old universal pre-K program is adopted by this body, then yes, charter schools would be able to have a pre-kindergarten program, and no, they would not be able to charge a fee.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner, on testing, if you'd like to amplify a bit further, and then we'll open it up for comments, questions, and I think then we'll get testimony as well before we go to Article 3.
Okay, we can do that now. With testing, as you know, part of our seven-point plan has always been to have better assessments, more useful assessments for student achievement, not to abandon testing outright. And you saw that also in the governor's letter. And so we convened a testing task force at the governor's request. We also had a testing task force that met prior to that to look at high school assessments. And I must say that the testing reduction task force did spend quite a number of their hours together discussing the high school assessments, mostly because of the federal requirements around grades 3 through 8. It's hard to see beyond what you can do in grades 3 through 8 when you know that there's a federal requirement. That's why in this proposal, we propose going just a bit further. We took the high school recommendations outside of high school science. They wanted to eliminate high school science. I don't think that sends a good message about science. So I didn't agree with that part of the proposal. But we went with the governor's proposal, we're going a little bit further in test reduction in order to increase learning time for children, increase opportunities for children to take other enriching activities and coursework in school, and then also still retain annual testing for children 3 through 8 and have them ready, Senator Dahl, for college and career ready. And I'll get into those specifics in just a moment. What's important to know about the high school testing, and Senator Dahl did bring this up, is that the ACT is no longer offering the Explore and Plan. The test reduction committee did spend time looking at their replacement product called the Aspire. They did not feel that that was an equal product, and the cost would be more. There are some other cumbersome administration pieces to it with students' emails, accounts, and personal data and that kind of thing being shared. Also, the reporting wasn't a similar reporting that schools have been using for years on the Explore and Plan, which is why we went to that system. And also, the test itself does not contain the career inventory, which we felt was of quite a bit of value to our counselors and our students and parents as they began to think about their course planning in high school and beyond in college. So the testing reduction task force did not recommend doing that test. And so we took those recommendations. So in high school, we are recommending eliminating the Explore and the Plan and the Compass test. And then contrary to what the test reduction task force had recommended, keeping the high school MCA for science. In elementary school, what we wanted to do was really focus on early literacy and foundational early literacy at the early grades and keep annual testing in the early grades for literacy, and then eliminate the grade 6 and 7th grade end of year accountability test, but then again do another dip in 8th grade to see where the kids are, and then of course testing in high school for reading. So they'd have 5 tests over their career in school. And really, I spent most of my time as a middle school teacher or principal or superintendent overseeing middle schools. And in 6th and 7th grade, what happens is you get some information about your students and their reading level, and you know where they are from the previous 7 years that they've been in our system. And you look at that literacy data, and then you typically, if a student's not on grade level, you schedule them a reading intervention class. And in that reading intervention, it's not their English language arts class because that's not where reading is taught. So they will get a reading intervention class typically, and then those teachers will work with them on a program. You know, many will choose Read 180 or some other type of program, reading intervention program. and they're formatively assessing those students weekly and sometimes even daily, looking at that information and getting information back to parents and programming for those students in grades 6 and 7. As you know, this is also very, in child development terms, tumultuous time for students in grades 6 and 7. And I think an end-of-year test in middle school is a bit late to be able to do those interventions. So I think we'd write in to this policy that students would continue as part of the literacy plan we passed back with Senator Jen Olson, and that students would have intervention every year if they are not reading on grade level. In terms of mathematics, as you know, our mathematics standards are very rigorous in Minnesota. And I've shared with this committee that we have the number one scores in math for fourth grade. Also, our African-American math students moving from 24th to 4th in the nation. So we do have some very rigorous math standards. Some of you may not know that this year's graduating class is the first class that will be required to take Algebra 1 and is the first class to have to have had Algebra 2 in high school, and the first class to have had Algebra 1 in 8th grade and pass it. So really, middle school becomes the time when we are starting to build the foundations to that algebra knowledge. Certainly, addition, subtraction, multiplication, all of the other things that you learn in elementary school matter in terms of your algebra knowledge in the future. But really, at that fourth and fifth grade level is when you start getting into more of the complex standards and the foundations for algebra knowledge. Since we're requiring them to pass Algebra 1 in eighth grade for graduation, we felt that we still needed to keep annual testing at grades 5, 6, 7, 8, and again in 11th grade. The reason that we are requiring this annual testing is because the concepts are different at each of the grade levels to get them ready for that Algebra 1 mastery. And so this is critically important, and then to build the foundation so that they can be successful for Algebra 2, which is also now a graduation requirement. So that's why we place the emphasis there in middle school for grades 5, 6, 7, and 8. It's important to note that we are not simply eliminating the tests. We are not requiring and mandating them of districts, but as many of you know from the test reduction task force and the survey we did, about 98% of our schools still give local tests. They give a lot of other tests to gauge students' knowledge and growth. So because we still retain this annual testing grades 3 through 8, we are going to be able to still give growth measures to teachers. But in grades 3 and 4 in mathematics, in grades 6 and 7, teachers will be able to use our MCA tests optionally. So they'll have greater flexibility in how they use those tests to be able to determine students' knowledge. So I think it's really important that we are not going to eliminate and stop making the tests. They'll still be available to teachers in those grades, but this just provides a little bit greater flexibility. Trying to see my notes and see what else I may have missed. Federal conformity. I wanted to be sure that you knew that we built into this policy federal conformity. I have sent email to the secretary and the assistant secretary for elementary secondary education informing them of this policy proposal. So they're aware. If you saw the secretary's comments yesterday in the Florida Sentinel, you would have seen that he said he thinks states ought to grapple with this, that if we are over-testing students, that we need to really think about that and examine that. He's recently made some decisions to give greater flexibility to Massachusetts, New Hampshire, to be able to look at how we can really reduce some of this overburden in testing and also be able to increase instructional time for our students. What's really particular about the way that we structured this, it's not grade span. We still have the annual testing where we think it's most needed. So it's most needed for early literacy. Then if you have a strong foundation, you can focus the reading in elementary. If kids are reading on grade level, they're going to do better on that problem solving for their algebraic knowledge and math knowledge. So then you test and keep the annual testing in middle school. I think that that's critical. In terms of the college ready that Senator Dahl brought up and why this was so important in terms of our 2013 legislation that we passed, we really want to be able to assess our kids' college and career ready. So part of that 2013 legislation was to be able to give college and career ready predictive scores for students moving into high school and how well they will do on the ACT test. So in this proposal, at fifth grade, they will take science, they will take reading, and they will take mathematics. That will be turned into a composite score and a predictor for how you will do on the ACT. We'll do that again in eighth grade and then in 11th grade so that we still continue to see and provide information to parents and also to our counselors so that they can give them the information. Maybe many of you have seen the Getting Prepared report, and you can see, and I know that the business partnership has talked about the value of the MCA test. And so we retain the MCA test, actually provide a little bit more importance to them, not just for accountability now, but for college going with this college and career ready score. Because we know that if students pass our math MCA, 90% of them go to college, and I think it's 9% within the first 2 years need developmental education. So we know that our tests are predictors of whether students are going to need remedial education and whether they go to college. So this is really critical that our state tests are aligned 100% to our state standards. We know our standards are very rigorous. And so I'm hoping that Dr. Rosenstone and Dr. Kaler will entertain a request to be able to have the university, state university systems look at our state tests for admissions. And in addition to the ACT, I think that that would be powerful. It would also be a huge motivator for students, and there would bring importance. And I think we'd see our scores go up because students would take the test seriously. They would know this is the test that matters. And so I'll close with saying that our kids really are taking a lot of tests. And they don't know which is the important tests to take. By limiting some of those tests and putting such a strong focus on our state tests, I think what we're doing is sending a strong message that we believe our tests ought to be aligned to what teachers are teaching and that teachers ought to be able to get the information in a timely, reasonable way, and that they are able to use that for their instruction as well as us being able to use that to hold schools accountable. And then I'll just leave it with, these aren't the same tests we created for No Child Left Behind. As you know, the history is we had Minnesota basic standards tests back in the mid-90s. Those tests were basic to eighth grade proficiency. Then we had the MCAs to attempt to have a high school kind of equivalency test. Now what we have are very rigorous tests aligned to college and career ready. And so in the past 4 years, we've made those tests better. They're online. They're adaptive, meaning the questions get easier and harder for students based on their individual capacity, which provides more precise information to teachers. The reporting is a lot better. And we are also making sure by 15-16 that those are off grade level. So teachers will be able to see how well students are performing, not only on the grade level standards, but are they performing just a little bit higher as well in their proficiency rates? So as we've worked this entire system in the 7-point plan to have tests be better and more useful, then we've been able to change our tests too, and teachers are able to get better reporting. So I'll leave it at that and take your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions that we're going to open up for any comments. We can take up to about 10 minutes for comments on testing. Of course, next week when we roll out the policy bill, there'll be additional opportunity as well. Additional comments from committee members at this point. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is the career exploration element, is that's leaving it to the districts to determine which of those? I know there's stuff out there. I teach a career unit, ninth grade, and there's good stuff out there, but you're not creating a product from the department, are you?
Mr. McHenry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, again, the career exploration element would continue in this legislation. With Explore and Plan going away, we are looking into what other options are available right now. Explore and Plan will be offered again next year. But we are looking into other options as far as just having a specific career exploration or career inventory that will be offered to all students in 8th and 10th grade.
Thank you. I believe that Mr. Bartholomew wanted to testify on testing. And if there's anyone else that would like to offer comments on the testing proposal, I invite you as well. And don't bump into each other for all you rushing up. Okay, Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As somebody comes up, I just wondering, do you know off the top of kind of the rough figure of what we spend on testing in the state in a biennium?
Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, it changes each year because based on enrollment, but I think the rough figure is somewhere around $15 million a year.
So about $30 million for the biennium?
I believe that's a rough estimate. It's a little bit lower than that, but close to that.
Thank you. We'll.
But we'll get it for you.
Thank you. And yes, for yes, testifying.
Good morning, Chair Uyghur, members of the committee. I'm Jody Olson, Education Issue Specialist at Education Minnesota. We appreciate and support this bill's focus on streamlining the standardized tests that our students are taking in a school year. We wanted to let you know that we look forward to working with MDE and our education partners as we strive to find the appropriate amount of testing that provides informative data for our students and their families, as well as data that will inform district and statewide decision-making. We know that our students, families, and teachers will appreciate the time made available for ongoing classroom instruction and activities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Anyone like to address us additionally? I had one question. Commissioner, you had hoped that the University of Minnesota and the MinSCU would agree with the definition or testing, and do you feel we're close to consensus on that?
Mr. Chair, I think we'll need Senator Bonoff's help with that. I think that the tradition has been to use the ACT, and in our proposal, we retain the ACT. The ACT is a timed test. Yes. My own children who, you know, score pretty well on standardized tests had difficulty when they took the Explore and Plan test simply because they ran out of time. They missed, I think, about a third of the questions because they just didn't get to them. And they got all the other questions right. So it was really disappointing for them to say, you know, come home and say, geez, I bombed this test. But when they got their report back, they saw that they got everything right that they were able to answer. The beautiful thing about our state test is that students have as much time as they need. We make accommodations for students who have disabilities. That's very challenging and difficult on the ACT. I do think that the ACT is still really important, but if the university and state university and college system would be willing to entertain using our state test as an equal or comparable measure, I think that would be a good thing to be able to see how students perform on that. And it will be, we would, you know, do research studies with their faculty to ensure that, you know, students who are performing at a certain level are also able to say that that's what they would have gotten on that ACT.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I think from what I understand, the biggest concern with regard to the University of Minnesota is that they, you know, recruit nationally, and that many times the students, as they apply to the University of Minnesota, apply to many, many other schools as well, and then they really decide much later which one they're going to go to. And so the University of Minnesota wants to use a test that is recognized nationally, as they particularly, it's so important to all these universities how they rank in U.S. News and World Reporter and any of the other publications, and so they have to be using a test whereby they can, you know, show how their students rank comparatively across the country. And so obviously you can't compare across the country when they're looking at that test. So I do appreciate the importance of that in terms of their being able to raise money, get research dollars and all of that, that their standing makes a difference. So I can appreciate that. The other problem we've had with MNSCU, and I don't know how this would affect that, but we object to that when a student does take an ACT, that they're still, even though they hit particular cut scores, they're still often asked to take the ACCUPLACER in addition. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a bill that passed out of committee and we sent to the floor saying that if they receive a certain score on the ACTs, that they would be exempt from the ACCUPLACER. So I would hope that we would be able to do something similar if MNSCU was more open to MCA as well.
And Senator Bonoff, as the commissioner said, you certainly would have some persuasive powers with MNSCU. And as everyone, we're looking at a pathway that's consistent and throughout the system. And so that'll be our goal. Commissioner Casalias.
Mr. Chair, I did bring this up with both President Kaler and Chancellor Rosenstone, and they both said that they would be absolutely open to, if we put the scores on the transcript, that would be one measure. So they would consider it, but that they would still require the ACT.
Yep. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I was just wondering, in this statement about you're going to create ways for the MCAs to be used to project students' secondary and post-secondary achievement, is that work underway, or how do you know at all how long that's going to take to develop that that method so that I think that would be very, very valuable to have that, and I'm just wondering how long that's going to take to develop.
Great. I'm going to, Mr. Chair, Senator Wicklund, I know that part of the 2013 legislation was to provide a career-ready score to our assessments, our state assessments. This would consolidate that work, and I'll let
Mark McHenry
talk about it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wicklund, again, Commissioner Casalias is correct. The legislation that passed in 2013 did require us to build in predictive scores into the MCAs already. So our division is already working on that with stakeholders to provide that predictability and looking at the statistics coming out of that right now. So that's something that we already currently are building and doing. And so being able to have these composite scores is something that we'll just be adding on top of those, the predictability of the MCAs.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, one other question. Regarding the waiver, do you have a sense if this bill passes, would you be able to start working towards implementing it? Or do you have to, if this passes, do you have to still wait for the waiver request to be responded to? How does that work?
Commissioner, on the waiver?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to report that we this past Friday had our waiver conversation with the U.S. Department of Education. As you know, we are in a group of six other states, an expedited review because of our good implementation. Actually, I heard the word stellar from the U.S. Department of Education in terms of how we're implementing our waiver, and we have broad consensus around that. It's just been a real lever and game changer for us in Minnesota and how we hold our schools accountable and how we support our schools with our regional centers of excellence. So they were very impressed with that. We do anticipate hearing on our waiver by March 31st. As part of the flexibility waiver process, you're allowed always to go back and make amendments to your waiver. So we would then, if this was to pass in June, we would then go to the secretary and put in a request for amendment, and they would look at our accountability, and they'd look at, we'd have to do a lot of proper regression analysis and validity studies to ensure that we're able to identify the right schools for priority and focus still. So we would then entertain that process. So it would take us a while. Now, I'm sure all of you know federally there's conversation about reauthorization of ESEA, And so this is also being debated in Congress currently by Senator Lamar Alexander and our own Congressman Klein. And they both have some differences of opinion right now on testing and state responsibility around accountability and assessment. So they're debating in Congress currently whether states should just be allowed to do whatever testing proposal they want to, or if they should have a formalized grade level and discipline testing regime for all states. So that's currently, if that changes, then we would be under that, but we'd still have a possibility for waiver to make a waiver unless they take away the authority for the secretary to give waivers. I know that's kind of a long process for them, but so there's kind of two things going on here at one time.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner, Mr. Bartholomew is here, and we can take a two-minute highlight, recognizing next week when we roll out the policy draft. We'll talk further about it as he approaches. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, the question I had for you was, in mentioning the Algebra 2 being added to the graduation, I was kind of looking to see if this was a better place to ask this question, but I can't find it. So in alternative schools, at-risk students, are they are, as I understand, they're also required to take the Algebra 2. The students have met with me, and I'm sympathetic to their situation, the importance of graduation on their behalf. I'm bringing it up because I told them I would.
Okay.
And to just respond to, especially for those students. The purpose of the Algebra 2 included, and your response maybe to them as to its value.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, actually probably Mr. Bartholomew can speak to that better than me. I wasn't there when these decisions were made to change the graduation requirements, Algebra 2. That was the previous administration. But I know that that was during a time of a great debate across the nation around whether the graduation requirements should be aligned to Algebra 1 or Algebra 2. Minnesota chose to align to Algebra 2, which is a very rigorous standard. And I know that there's still a great debate, even among faculty at the University of Minnesota, about whether they should require mastery of Algebra 1 concepts or whether Algebra 2 is required. It's a graduation requirement that we've never come back to and had discussion about.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, thank you. I think for regular students, graduation rate, this was in particular the alternative school at-risk students that are struggling to graduate, and so for them. And so I am absolutely I appreciate the discussion. And doing that, is it more important to have a thorough mastery and whatever you do as a foundation? Is it also good to include some physics, introduction to physics? Do we spend a lot of time on Algebra 1 and Algebra 2, and then, you know, there's only so much time you have in those days, and so on. But I just want to make sure that you understand this was in particular to the alternative school students.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, there are, we don't delineate certain student populations for graduation requirements. All students are required to meet our graduation students. Even students with disabilities are required to meet our graduation requirements. Students who are new to country are required to meet our graduation requirements. We don't say, oh, you don't have to meet them. So I think that becomes very challenging and difficult, and you're bringing up a good thing to discuss in the future.
Okay, it'll be a good answer for them next time.
Okay. Mr. Bartholomew, 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Jim.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you briefly about Senate File 1495 and why we would ask that you not move forward with this bill. We believe that the state should require only exams that are aligned with our state academic standards. As a result, we support the bill's repeal of the Explore, Plan, and Compass exams. Not only did the department find that these exams weren't aligned with our state standards, but they're being discontinued or not meeting the legislature's expectations. And there's been broad consensus that dropping these exams makes sense, which makes it so much harder to understand what's behind the policy driving the other proposed changes in this bill. If the new policy is we want to give families, educators, and the public less information about student performance, this bill does that. If we want to make it harder to identify successful schools, this bill does that. If we want to continue making huge shift in states' assessment policies, this bill does that. Minnesota has created a strong student assessment system, which has given parents, educators, and the public valuable information on how well our students are performing relative to our state's reading and math standards, grades 3 through 8 in high school, science in grades 5, 8 in high school. The governor's testing reduction advisory group spent many hours reviewing and discussing federal, state, and local student assessment laws and practices. At the end of those discussions, there was consensus on keeping reading and math and science exams in grades 3 through 8. These recommendations were reinforced when the commissioner submitted her letter to the legislature just a month ago. Why do these recommendations make so much more sense than what's proposed in Senate File 1495? Because under the working group's recommendations, families, educators, and the public would continue to have 6 years of information, grades 3 through 8, on student performance in reading and math. Under the governor's proposal, this is reduced to only 2 years. As a parent, as a policymaker, would you rather have 6 years of information or two? Another way to look at it is for grade K-5 elementary schools. Only once would you have combined information for reading and math. For a K-4 elementary, you'd have no combined information. Objective information on how well students are doing in reading and math is critical. It's why a diverse coalition of employers and civil rights groups, it's the letter I had handed out, are writing at the national level, are writing members of Congress telling them that annual assessments in reading and math in grades 3 through 8 in high school must be continued as part of the reauthorization of ESEA. How are we going to evaluate school performance? Again, for many elementary schools, K-4 or less, they'll just have reading scores. Will this be a detriment to schools that serve large numbers of ESL students, for example? If you're only looking at reading performance, they may not stand out. But we found many of these schools do tremendously well in math, and on balance are outperforming many of their peers. With Senate File 1495, the success of these schools will go unnoticed. What about the state's school rating system, the MMR? Right now, it's based on reading and math in grades 3 through 8. Are we really going to say math isn't important in elementary schools or reading isn't important in middle schools? Rather than providing some consistency in state assessment policies, as the working group and commissioner proposed, Senate File 1495 creates another huge shift in policy. We know you've heard from parents and educators that they'd like more stability in state policy. We agree. Finally, Senate File 1495 does nothing to address local decisions that lead to concerns about too much testing. This was another area where the commissioner made a recommendation that we thought had merit. Specifically, limit total testing to a percentage of instructional time. Instead of addressing these concerns, Senate File 1495 undermines participation in state exams by saying that opting out is acceptable. The concern is the department will create this list with the message that it's okay not to participate in state exams. This list and its message can then be used by groups opposed to exams to try to persuade parents to opt out. This is not the best way to address parent concerns. Senate File 1495 will provide less information and cause more confusion. We ask that you not adopt this approach and instead work from the recommendations presented by the commissioner earlier this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. A brief response, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senators and Mr. Bartholomew, who was part of the testing task force report, I did recommend 2% to this legislature that you think about that. I think that that obviously has local control impacts. But there's also ways to be able to say that if a board felt that they had to test more than up 2% of their time, that they could align that to the world's best workforce and have a hearing and report to parents why they think over-testing more than 2% was important to student achievement, and you could provide that kind of flexibility. As for the less information to parents, our students are still tested 5 years of their 12 years in our system. They're not even tested kindergarten, first, and second grade. Many of our schools are configured K through 4, so they only have 1 year of information anyway at elementary school. So I don't think that our recommendations here are going to have any impact on our accountability system or information to parents. And why? Because Mr. Bartholomew didn't say that these tests are still going to be available. And because we know schools are testing 98% with a lot of other tests, they're going to probably use the MCA test, but they're going to have greater flexibility around how they use it.
Thank you, Commissioner. We'll go next to Article 3. And again, if it's a technical, non-controversial, just acknowledge that, and we'll open it up then for any additional comment. Mr. Hoover?
Sections 1 and 2 remove references to the Minnesota Resource Center serving deaf and hard of hearing. These duties are not carried out by MDE. We are aware of some concerns with removing these references, and we'll be sure to work with those who are concerned.
Now, just note, I know there's advocates in the audience, and to reiterate that those concerns are being addressed.
Section 3 clarifies.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if you could, when you refer to these with new sections, give us the page number.
Are you following in the summary or the bill?
The bill.
I'll do my best.
Maybe I can look ahead for you.
Page 40 now. Please proceed. We're at page 40.
I believe I'm up to page 42 now in the bill.
Okay.
Section 3 clarifies the responsibility for transportation to and from early learning sites outside of the school district setting as is limited to the transportation for services required as part of an IEP team decision. Sections 4, 5, and 6 are technical changes to the Interagency Early Interventions Committee. Section 7, which I believe is starting on page 48, in order to meet the requirements of having a systems of payment policy under the state's Part C policy for early learning, the bill would add Part C references to the statute. Section 8 allows a state interagency coordinating council 30 days to recommend policies after receiving the Part C annual performance report from the Office of Special Education. Currently, those recommendations are expected the day that the Part C report is received. This would give some time to actually do the work.
Okay.
Sections 9 and 10. We're up to page 53 in the bill, I believe. Our technical language changes to reflect the fact that the work of the Resource Center for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing is now at MDE.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could go back to page 46 for a moment. The local agency coordination responsibilities. This looks to me like it's new language setting forward a new procedure, or is it in terms of intergovernmental cooperation? Could somebody just let us know what's happening here?
Gotcha.
Looks like it might be technical.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I do believe that that's a technical change.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Sections 11 and 12, which are up to page 54 in the bill, are meant to conform the intent of 2013 legislation. The language would clarify that the special education aid will be paid directly to cooperatives, education districts, and intermediate districts. Section 13 is repealing language in a technical cleanup in relation to the transfer of the resource centers for the deaf or hard of hearing and the blind or visually impaired to MVP. And that's Article 3, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, comments? Article 4.
Article 4 starts on page 57 of the bill. Section 1, it's the only section in the article. It would remove the reporting requirement by districts for a telecom aid. Currently, that report does come to MDE. We feel that it's no longer necessary.
Questions? Article 5.
Article 5, Section 1, also on page 57, ensures that children receiving Race to the Top early learning scholarships will be able to receive a state scholarship at the end of the Race to the Top grant until they are in kindergarten. Section 2 would add that children in foster care or experiencing homelessness or who have a parent under 21 who's continuing their education would be added to a list of prioritized students for early learning scholarships. Section 3 outlines the disqualifying factors for program providers who seek to provide services for early learning scholarship recipients. Section 4, which is on page 59 of the bill, requires programs participating in early learning scholarship programs to maintain records. In the language, it does ask that this would be for students who are participating. There may be some questions about how long, but that is the intent.
Thank you. I believe Mr. Forsberg would like to testify from the Greater Twin Cities United Way, if he's here. Yes. And Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I think it's also important to note that in this area of scholarships, there are additional policy recommendations in our budget bill.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Forsberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for allowing the testimony today. My name is Frank Forsberg, and I work at Greater Twin Cities United Way as a senior vice president, and I also chair the Mini Minds Coalition. Mini Minds is a statewide coalition with more than 100 members, and since our creation a little more than 2 years ago, we've been very focused on addressing the needs of 20,000 low-income children in our state, 3, 4, and 5 years old, who are on a waiting list of some kind and really wanting to participate in a high-quality early learning program. So it's with that background that I wanted you to hear the reflections here. I've got just a couple of comments. First, on page 57, line 30, there's been a nice ad here where teen parents who also might be pursuing a college degree, I think that's a good ad in its intention. We'd just like to see the college degree language maybe modified to be a little more flexible, maybe pursuing a post-secondary certificate, something that might just be a little more achievable or sequential for the type of student we might be talking about. But directionally, we like that direction.
I believe everybody's nodding their head in agreement.
Yeah, it's a very very minor modification.
But important, yes.
On page 58, line 6, it was just highlighted that the intent here is to extend scholarships for students in our state who might be receiving a Race to the Top scholarship. And there's just an important distinction I want to make here and then a request for modification. The Race to the Top scholarships, which are in 4 communities and have been for the last 3 years, are very flexible scholarships. And it's allowed parents to enroll their children in the type of program that they think their children need. And in some cases, in fact, many cases, those scholarships have been used for full-day, year-round care. So while we're very supportive and appreciative of extending these scholarships with, if you will, Minnesota state scholarships, we'd love to see make sure that the level of funding support for those scholarships would be the same, meaning if a child's enrolled in a full-day, year-round program, the extension would also allow that same level of flexibility. We would hate to see a child who's enrolled in a very high-quality, year-round, full-day program have to be somehow put in a different program, reduced to halftime. So thank you. On page 58, line 27, we really want to affirm the direction here. of identifying our highest priority populations. Again, many of the examples we have from the Race to the Top scholarships are the most vulnerable children and families really need and benefit from full-day, year-round scholarships. It also allows programs in our state to provide a two-generation approach to addressing the issue of intergenerational poverty. And the stability of those year-round full-day scholarships really make it possible for parents to enroll in school or to work full-time. Many parents do want that. We'd love to see that addition there. And then finally, my last comment is on page 60, and it's line 25. Really just want to strengthen the language here. A scholarship must be used in a program, perhaps inserting high-quality parent-aware rated program to really strengthen the commitment there. Last time, just to emphasize scholarships being directed in a very flexible way so the needs of the children are fully met.
Thank you, Mr. Forsberg. Staff is taking careful notes. There will be an amendment to this, and again, this will all be incorporated with changes in our bill next week. Thank you. Please proceed to Article 6.
Article 6, Mr. Chair, starts on page 60 of the bill. It requires that a regional library chief administrative officer be a full-time position. That's the only section for Article 6.
Questions? Article 7. Excuse me. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm just a little bit puzzled. This seems like a very why would you want to mandate a full-time position in a particular regional library? It just seems like a detail of that should be left more to the library system. Just kind of an odd thing.
Okay. Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, again, Kevin McHenry of the Department of Education. This is just clarifying that the regional public library system, that each regional public library will have a chief administrative officer. The reason that we're asking for this change is it establishes a standard for organizational leadership. It's needed to ensure that the management structure of the regional library system best supports the needs of the city, county, and library members, and its requirements related to the management of state, city, county, and federal funds. It strengthens the accountability for regional system administrators to make sure that they are actually in their specific region, spending time with their specific stakeholders, including city, county, and residents. This also solves a problem of limited availability of chief administrative officers. There's an example that we've been dealing with part-time. Part-time regional administrators that were on contract. There was a divisive issue between a library and some of its board or some of its library members that actually led to a discontinuation of services for constituents in the district. MDE had to spend some significant time with the Bureau of Mediation Services to reestablish connection between the regional library and the individual library to make sure that the services were still there for all of constituents in Minnesota. And so by doing this, this is just making sure that it's including a one specific chief administrator for that specific district, and it's representing the interests of that specific region.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I when I look at this, I know libraries have met with all of us in regards to their funding, and this is going to be an expense and a cost, and I understand the particular situation, but that can happen even if you have a full-time person. So I don't know that it really does that, but my concern is for library finances, and this is requiring a full-time.
Yeah, that's noted. Finally, Article 7.
Article 7, Mr. Chair, Section 1 would formalize an informal agreement that MMB and MDE have around the November forecast. It's moving back by 1 week, our deadlines, so that we can include the general election results into a forecast. Section 2, starts on page 61 of the bill, allows the third grade reading report to be reported in World's Best Workforce Reporting rather than directly to the Commissioner of Education. This is in line with trying to streamline some reporting that districts are doing to MDE. Section 3 would allow for alternative teacher pay reporting to be included in World's Best Workforce. Section 4 would allow for the staff development report from districts to MDE to be included in World's Best Workforce. It also makes a change allowing for MDE to include our staff development report to the legislature to have it be made on February 1st, which would, it would also, Section 5 then would, this is in line with a hope by MDE to have one report to the legislature on February 1st. There'll be some sections coming up that will relate to that. Section 5 requires parties involved in the dissolution of cooperatives and their member districts to split the cost of the proceedings. These costs currently go to MDE. They can be, sometimes it's a time-consuming and costly process, and the bills from that end up to MDE, and we're asking that those costs be split between the parties. Section 6 moves up the deadline for school districts to submit audited financial data for the preceding fiscal year to MDE from November 30th to November 15th. Moves up the deadline for school districts to submit audited financial statements to MDE from December 31st to December 15th. It moves up the deadline for MDE to post school district consolidated financial statements to the web from February 15th to February 1st. The earlier deadlines for districts to report audited financial data to MDE will help to ensure that MDE is able to complete the February forecast on time based on the final data for the prior fiscal year. Section 7 changes the date of the litigation cost report in order to make it part of a single report by the commissioner to the legislature. Section 8 changes the due date for the teacher workforce report to February 1st of the odd number year, and have that be a part of the commissioner's single report to the legislature. Section 9 forms the one report to the legislature by the commissioner. Section 10 would move the deadline for aid payments for the previous fiscal year to be finalized from December 30th. 15th. Other technical changes around that. This with Section 6 would help to ensure that MDE is able to complete February forecast on time. And Section 11 changes the Interstate Compact on Education Opportunity for Military Children to have the chair be the Commissioner of Education. Currently, it's whoever is the chair of the P20 working group, and that is a rotating chair. We feel it'd be more appropriate for it to just continue to be the Commissioner of Education.
Thank you. Questions on Article 7? On the entire bill, is there any additional comments you want to note at this point for the record? Is anyone in the audience that would like to express any concern or comment regarding the draft, recognizing that next week we'll have this included in part with some amendments in our policy draft? Not to thank you very much for the presentation, and Senate File 1495 will be laid over.
Thank you.
Next is Senate File 1210. I believe Senator Hoffman is outside the hall. If someone could get him, I believe it's his intent to lay Senate File 1210 on the table, and then we will be going to Senate File 1001 on student discipline. Senator Hoffman, I mentioned that you may want to make a motion that Senate File 1210 be laid on the table. That be correct?
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, that is correct. I'd like to table Senate File 1210.
On that motion, that Senate File 1210 be tabled. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
It's tabled. We now have before us Senate File 1001, addressing student discipline, Senator Hoffman, and we ask that your testifiers join you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. With me at the table today are Barb Zimke and Sue Abderholden. I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1001. It's a proposal to update student discipline law to reflect evidence-based best practices. Before I begin my presentation, I would like to move an A1 author's amendment that puts the bill in the shape that I would like. 12th hour yesterday on a conference call with some folks, we needed to make some changes, and we know that we're going to need to make some changes going further. So before others folks comes up here with with powder in their guns. I hope they realize that I'm willing to work with them. So,
okay, Senator Hoffman moves the A1 author's amendment, which will be explained in the presentation. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Adopted. We have Senate File 1001 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Barb Zimke and Sue Adler-Holden are here, and I just wanted to briefly tell you the evidence is overwhelming that exclusionary discipline practices like suspensions and expulsions do more harm than good. I would like to draw attention to the Minnesota Department of Education handout that should be in your packets that shows some key components. Yes, y'all, everybody has that. Key components of this bill are, and I'll be real brief, it prohibits suspension, exclusion, expulsions of students in pre-kindergarten through grade 3, except when the student will create an immediate and substantial danger. Number 2, it requires schools to try alternatives before suspending a student, except when the student creates an imminent or substantial danger. It also updates alternatives to suspension to include current best practices, such as restitution, community service, and school suspension or implementing a positive behavioral intervention plan. And number 4, it requires that parents be notified when a student is removed by the school by a peace officer. So at this time, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to the presentation to my testifiers, starting with Barb Zimke.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Barb Zimke. I'm a senior advocate at PACER Center, where I've worked as a parent trainer and advocate for 13 years. PACER is a nonprofit statewide parent training and information center for families of children with all kinds of disabilities. We have over 30 years of experience working in partnership with families and educators to improve outcomes for students with disabilities. PACER and the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, of which we're a part, support Senate File 1001, a bill which updates the student discipline law to reflect evidence-based best practices. In order to improve student outcomes and reduce the significant achievement gap, we all share a goal in Minnesota around that. Students, first and foremost, have to be in their classrooms learning. They have to have access to the instruction. And research has repeatedly shown that discipline practices such as suspension and expulsion that exclude students from learning environments are ineffective. The information sheet that you have been provided by the Department of Education there in your packet further describes studies and the negative impacts of exclusionary practices. We're also really concerned at PACER and in the coalition because of the recent data from the Department of Education that shows that while students with disabilities compose about 13% of the student population, 43% of students who are suspended or excluded or expelled are students with disabilities. So this is really critical. We also know that students of color are also disproportionately affected by exclusionary discipline practices, which result in achievement issues. This bill, then, will help students with and without disabilities remain in the classroom with appropriate positive behavioral supports. I'm just going to go by sections. What the proposal is, we're reinforcing our support of. In Section 1, it prohibits suspensions, exclusions, and expulsions of students in pre-kindergarten through grade 3, except where it appears to the school administrator that the pupil will create an immediate and substantial danger to themselves, to other surrounding people, or property. Instead, alternatives to suspension are to be used, which we'll see later and listed later in the bill. The research shows that children this young don't learn anything by being suspended. It means that they're losing time, particularly when it's a critical period of the development, in their development, and the acquisition of foundational learning skills. Section 2 reflects the current law that requires schools to report each exclusion or expulsion to the Commissioner of Education. We have an additional requirement in that when there's a verbal or written agreement by a parent to withdraw a child from school as an alternative to expulsion, that this also needs to be reported and tracked. A principal may tell a parent, "We're going to begin expulsion proceedings against your child. You can save us both trouble by agreeing to withdraw your child from school." When that occurs, we think that needs to be reported. And then our bill also in that section requires that the dismissal summary data that the department already requires will should be on a school district website, unless doing so would risk exposing a student's personally identifiable information. In Section 3, current law requires schools to have a discipline policy that emphasizes preventing dismissals through early detection of problems. This bill adds to that by requiring schools to avoid using suspension and expulsion from school until alternatives have actually been tried, except, again, where it appears to the school administrator that the pupil will create an immediate and substantial danger to themselves or to others or to property. So except in the most serious cases, suspension and expulsion should be a last resort rather than a first response to misbehavior. Section 3 also states that schools are responsible for the education of a pupil during the period when one of those agreements of parents to withdraw a child from school as an alternative to expulsion is in effect, as it is now for dismissals. Section 4 adds four additional alternatives to suspension to what's currently listed in the statute in an effort to give the administrators and educators more options. And these additions are based on current best practices. And you might want to just look there now in the bill. You can see what was added. Senator Hoffman alluded to those already. But these are such things as restitution, community service, in-school suspension, and the implementation of positive behavior intervention plans. In Section 5, the current law has a list of components that must be included in a school discipline policy. One of these is an agreement to coordinate crisis services with counties. Our bill adds language around the mobile crisis response teams, which are a wonderful resource available to schools. And it deletes language in current law that limits those services to students with an emotional disturbance or students with an IEP, since we know there are other students with mental health issues and situations where getting some assistance in this area would really be helpful for schools. Then lastly, in Section 6, our bill requires schools to make reasonable efforts to immediately contact the parents of any student who is removed from a school building or school grounds by a peace officer, unless that's otherwise prohibited by law. This is just common sense, and really a lot of people are surprised to even think this would need to be in a bill. But yet, we talked to parents at PACER who are really upset because they were unaware that their child had been removed from school and taken to the police station until the child failed to return home that day from school. And we just think that shouldn't be happening. So I just want to thank you for your thoughtful consideration of this proposed legislation, which has the potential to increase instructional time for students and, as a result, foster positive learning outcomes for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sumpke. Ms. Aberholt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Aberholt, and Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we're here to speak in support of Senate File 1001. That would have schools view suspension policies differently, especially as they relate to young students in elementary school. Developmentally, it simply does not make sense to suspend a child, especially in grades K through 3. If a child does something so egregious that they need to be suspended, then frankly something is wrong. That child is having problems for a reason, and suspending him or her teaches them nothing to prevent reoccurrence. There are a number of reasons for the behavior that led to the suspension. The child could have behaviors that are related to poor attachment, exposure to trauma, or early symptoms of a mental illness. Let's take a child's poor attachment to a parent. That can be caused by abuse, neglect, emotional unavailability on the part of the caretaker. This has a negative effect on the child's brain functioning and their structure. Exposure to traumatic events as a young child also impacts the very structure of the brain. The ACE study, the adverse childhood experiences. Trauma can lead, can include abuse, neglect, car accidents, tornado, the death of a loss of a loved one, life-threatening illnesses in a caregiver, witnessing domestic or community violence, and even generational or historical trauma. Symptoms of a mental illness can also appear in a young child. They can include severe mood swings, overwhelming fear for no reason, dangerous or out-of-control behavior, fighting frequently, trouble focusing, or sitting still. So all three of these particular issues can lead to the very behaviors for which a child is suspended.
and what a teacher may see in a classroom is a child with low self-esteem, needy, clingy, or pseudo-independent behavior, inability to deal with stress and adversity, lack of self-control, inability to develop and maintain friendships, alienation from and opposition to parents, caregivers, and other authority figures, antisocial attitudes and behaviors, aggression and violence, difficulty with genuine trust, intimacy, and affection, negative, hopeless, pessimistic view of themselves, family, and society, lack of empathy, incessant chatter and questions, difficulty learning, and apathy. So if we suspend a child for these very things, then what does that do? It essentially removes a problem child from the school. It provides temporary relief to frustrated school staff and teachers, and it points out to the parent that the child misbehaved. But ultimately, does it really change the behavior? Does it teach a student self-regulation skills, coping skills, problem-solving skills, or empathy? It does not. These children need to have their trauma addressed, they need to learn social-emotional skills, and they need to have their mental health needs addressed. We need policies that promote student growth through positive interventions and that do not remove children from the opportunity to learn. For all these reasons, NAMI Minnesota supports this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Aronson. Senator Claussen, as he approaches.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to put on my former principal's hat and have some concerns here. I think there are times where you need to remove a student, especially when you're talking about a one-time consequence for teaching a lesson, so to speak. I'll give you a couple examples. 20 years ago, I remember before school, a group of young people in a pickup truck with a Confederate flag driving through the parking lot with racial slurs, bringing them into the building and going through a process of imposing out-of-school or in-school suspension or in-school suspension would not be appropriate. You'd just be raising the tension in the school. You need to get that student off campus. You have a student that you find is selling chemicals or drugs in the school. You want to get them out. If you have a student that is attending an athletic event or after-school event and is using chemicals, you want to get them out. So those are some examples. In line 2.6, I think this is probably something a lot of principals have dealt with. A student is about to be expelled from one district. Student withdraws, and he shows up on the school district next door to be enrolled. Two occasions come to mind. One was a student that was starting fires in his previous school, and now he's here at my doorstep wanting to come in. Another student had been moved to be expelled, withdrew from school for selling drugs. The next day he's at my doorstep wanting to come in. How do I respond to the students and the other adults in the building and parents saying, sure, let's admit those students versus having the school district that was moving to expel deal with their education in an appropriate way? I think, too, if you look at 2.3, about alternative restoration consequences. I've certainly been involved in doing those, but sometimes those are expensive. You have to hire a person to staff an in-school suspension building. Do counselors and others in the building have enough time to go through a process with students? And I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that with some students, but there are students that don't need that. Many times they might just need a consequence, a one-time consequence, and the behavior changes and they learn the lesson. On line 3.1, I'm a little concerned about coordinating crisis service to the extent funds are available. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Does that mean helping to pay for hospitalization of a student who may be suicidal or has mental health issues, paying for treatment? In the past, there have been scams, I'll call them scams, where parents have hired an attorney claiming the school district didn't identify the learning disability, whatever, and we're going to be sending that student to a private institution out of state at $10,000 a month. Is the school district responsible for that? So those are just some of the things, but I think there's also some really good things in here about recognizing when there's a substantial danger to a self or surrounding persons. But those would be some concerns that I would have. And certainly what we're trying to do is to get a policy for all students, and perhaps not all students really fit into this model.
Sir. Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, thank you. Those are the issues. It was funny because yesterday afternoon, there's somebody that I asked to come here today and who probably forgets more in a day than anybody in this room will ever know under the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act or discipline of students. Was once a former member that worked at the Minnesota Department of Education and I'm going to seek out again and help Dr. Darren Kermes, who really understands this issue probably better than us in this room. And I understand the hat you wear as an administrator. I wore that as a school board member. I did serve for 8 years, not 16 like somebody next door, but I did serve for 8 years on the school board, and we dealt with these issues. This should not affect the change of the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act that dramatically, because we're only talking about a small incident of children here, specifically when it comes to those that might perhaps have a special education need that are on an IEP. And so I'm going to have and Senator Claussen, I'll be more than happy to sit down with you, just like I had asked you about the Part C provisions. I'd be more than happy to sit down. We can have that discussion as well. If I don't need to bring Dr. Kermes up, I'd like to have Sue Abderholden talk about the crisis team that's there.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sue Abderholden with NAMI. With the crisis teams, because they're not fully funded around the state yet, although there is a bill in Health and Human Services that would hopefully do that, and with all of your votes, of course. But if we had, so it is within the available funds. So we do have some areas of the state that don't have mobile teams, so there's not a mobile team, so it wouldn't come out. And we don't expect that a school would pay for a hospitalization because that's not going to be on an IEP. The mobile team comes out, and then that falls under that child's insurance to pay for mobile crisis teams. That's currently what we do now.
Senator Kiffmeyer, then we're going to ask Mr. Aronson to join us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was attended an event one time, again, with students.
We have to be out here.
And the students shared at that time their frustration when a school or classroom is disrupted and how it hinders their learning. I know it's a real challenge to balance the needs of all the students, the needs of those who are there who want to learn, and then some other students who are acting out. We can't determine sometimes right away just the reason why, but it is a disruption. And I think it is important that we empower our classrooms, teachers, school facility in general, to make sure that we help create a safe environment for learning and that those students are also protected while we take care of maybe those who have a problem or an issue. I get concerned when we turn our classrooms into something that is beyond a learning environment for education. And I just want to make that comment again on behalf of students who said, don't you care about us too? We're here and we just want to learn.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Actually, there are a couple points, and I'm going to let Barb Zimke handle the first part of that with you. So.
Okay, thank you.
Zimke.
I just want to respond because I think we share the same hope that our classrooms can be really conducive to learning. And I think it's important to point out that this is not taking away a right of a classroom teacher to have a student leave that classroom for a period of time. We're one of the additional proposals is an alternative of an in-school suspension, for instance, or a positive intervention behavior plan so that when the student perhaps does need to be removed from a classroom, whatever the consequences are and whatever the instruction that's delivered will reduce the chance that that'll happen again. Because I talk with a lot of educators and I come out of the area of education myself. The issue is for some students that removal doesn't make a difference. And that's what some of this research is really pointing to, that if the consequence of, getting rid of the child, so to speak, was that the next time he wasn't going to misbehave and do it again, that might be a different issue. But we're seeing from the research that in fact, doesn't occur. And what we're trying to do is say when that occurs, what can we do as far as something that will have an effect on the student that will be longer range and lasting so that it doesn't keep occurring, not to take away any consequence, but making the consequence one that is effective and changes the behavior over time. In some schools, it's a, you know, there are multiple infractions by the same student, for instance. And so getting to what can we do to make that lesson and those alternatives. But it's clearly a concern.
Mr. Aronson.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent, excuse me, I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, and I know you have a really busy agenda and you're going to work really long today. This is one of the most important bills to school principals here this year. I would say testing and this would be the two things that we'd be most interested in. And we appreciate working with Senator Hoppen, and we've exchanged some proposals back and forth to resolve some of these issues. But a couple of things we want you to think about here in this bill. There is a lot of discussion right now about the reduction of suspensions in schools, not only in Minnesota, but nationwide. This has come out of the federal government since January of 2014. And the question typically in that setting is that schools need to be, number one, safe and supportive, which you all would agree to, and then number two, that we need to avoid the overuse of suspension in schools. Now, about 20 years ago, Minnesota suspended about 65,000 kids a year, and a disproportionate number of those were special ed kids. We have reduced that number significantly without this bill. If you look at the department data, and we've been reporting suspension data for now over 25 years, in the 2009 school year, we reduced that to 50,000. If you look at the data for 13-14, we've reduced that to 43,000. And frankly, if you look at the data very closely, a disproportionate number of those suspensions are centered in particular districts. Now, a couple things that you can draw from that. Number one, the one-size-fits-all answer is not the best approach. And I want to talk a few things about the technical provisions in the bill. If we talk about the kids that are 4 through 12, you now have some language that says we are to avoid using suspensions until we've tried all of the other approaches. Okay? Now, I pulled some of the data out for you to think about. But in the 13-14 year, we did suspend 500 kids for being under the influence of alcohol. We suspended 2,126 for the possession of illegal drugs in Minnesota schools. You can go through the 1,478 kids that are involved in theft. These are all significant issues, and from time to time, we need the student out of the building. I know that there's some sense of saying the kid doesn't learn anything when they're out of the building, and that's true, and we're trying to change this because we want our test scores to go up, and we want to have the kids here, but to do that, we need after-school programs. We need counselors that can do these restorative justice programs that are referred to in this statute. We need assistant principals that can meet with parents and talk about the problems. We need folks to staff the in-school suspension rooms. If this bill had all of those things in it, we would be dancing in the aisles and saying we could not support it more. But if you say we can't use this one tool and you give us no resources to address the underlying problems, as Susan Aberholden so nicely pointed out, particularly for the students in the younger grades, we have, and we're going to continue to share that data back and forth. But there are times when a suspension is very effective in deterring future behavior, particularly in the students on the other grade. I want to comment on one little provision in here that I think is a problematic piece for you. And this has become a very important part of the statute. If you look in the policies to be established section, and that starts on page 1, and there's a line there that says, in current law, actually it's on 2.4, and it says, the policy shall recognize the continuing responsibility for the education of the pupil during the dismissal period. What that means in Minnesota is that even if we expel a kid, the district has the continuing obligation to provide educational services to him. Okay, you've made a policy decision that we are going to continue to work with these kids. All right, we accept that and we're doing it. Now you're going to add a line that says, if they've withdrawn the child, we'd have an obligation to provide services to him. I don't think that works. If they're withdrawn, they're not our kid anymore. They're going to another school, as Senator Claussen so nicely pointed out previously. And this isn't really a turf issue on that. I think that just doesn't work. And I think when you get down to the end of this, Local school districts can adopt best practices for their people with their own policies. One of the proposals that we've circulated back and forth and is to say that each school district should adopt an elementary disciplinary policy, you know, that would emphasize the use of alternatives to suspension. We think that's the type of nudging that you ought to do on this issue that looks very local to us. So, Mr. Chair, we're going to continue to work with Senator Hoffman and the advocates on this, and hopefully we can come out with something that works for everybody. And I answer any questions.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I will have to respectfully disagree with you, Mr. Aronson, and I just couldn't more strongly agree with Senator Hoffman. You know, even in the examples used, a student is using alcohol or using drugs, and then they're suspended. You know, this is not kind of a leave it to beaver environment where we suspend our kids and they go home with mom and dad and they learn about, you know, how terrible it was that they were doing what they were doing. We're taking these kids who are really confronting some pretty challenging things, and we're sending them probably back home where there's no supervision. And then expecting it to turn out all right. And I don't think it does turn out all right. I think once you suspend a child, now you've got a label on them, and they act different. They're, you know, as has been said. And particularly, I get concerned about these young. I'm always shocked when I hear we suspend kindergartners, first graders, second graders. I can't even imagine a situation that's the appropriate answer. And I do appreciate that Senator Hoffman uses the statement in there about except will create an immediate and substantial danger to self or surrounding persons or property. And still, I would urge school districts in that situation to do anything to avoid suspending them. So I just think that this is a very serious issue. I do agree with you, Mr. Aronson, that it might be one of the more important issues that we're dealing with, but I'm not looking for a nudge in this particular case. I'm looking for us to say very strongly and emphatically that we want school districts to find a way to deal with these. Because if we just suspend them or expel them, then they're now our problem when they're 25 or 26, and then where are they? You know, if we haven't figured out a way to intervene and change the trajectory of their lives, do they end up in our prison system? You know, I'm very concerned about this pattern, and I think that as we confront all the issues that go into our achievement gap, that this one is part of the tool in the toolbox. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I totally want to echo Senator Bonner's comments, and I want to applaud your effort, Senator Hoffman, for bringing this forward. I was having a conversation with my son, who just came back from college for spring break, and he was telling me about how many times they did things that were bad and they were not suspended, and how many times his black friends did things that were not as bad and they were suspended, and the impact that those suspensions have had on his African-American friends. And it was just painful to hear that conversation. This just happened 2 days ago, interestingly. Tomas is 20 years old. And so I believe that the suspensions of African-American boys in particular has gone too far in Minnesota, and that needs to stop. And I think we need to let the schools know that we expect better and that we are not going to deal with the consequences later on of what happens when a child is suspended or expelled from school. And then they are not able to go to college. They are not able to pursue their dreams as a result of this. And so I believe very strongly that this bill needs to move forward, and then we will deal. It's interesting, Mr. Anderson, that you will say, we will be dancing if you put money behind this. Well, come and help us. We have almost $2 billion right now. Come and help us secure the funding that we need to be dancing around this particular proposal.
Senator Kent, Senator Claussen, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm also going to echo what Senator Bonhoff and Senator Torres-Ray have said. And Mr. Aronson, I want to thank you for your comments and talking about the need for more counselors. And I'm going to use this moment to remind everybody that Minnesota ranks 48th in the nation in the ratio of counselors to students, and it's not okay. I noticed in the department's fact sheet that it says that suspension prevents the student from obtaining school support services. So we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We should address the problem and make sure that principals aren't in a position to have feel like they have no other options, because they don't have any other option. They don't have the staff there. So I look forward to everybody involved in this conversation supporting my bill to provide more student support services, including counselors.
Thank you. Sarah Clausen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. I think it's important that we give students consequences. That's part of their education. And I think also you have to look at the other students. If you're not giving consequences, and what message are you really sending to them, that negative behavior is perhaps okay? There are cases where you need to remove the student from school. The other thing I'd like to point out, in every suspension, there's always a reentry conference that takes place with the parents. And that's where you start looking at, okay, let's build a plan now to make you successful in our school, and also so that we can avoid the kinds of behaviors that we've been seeing. So I think, you know, these are good intentions, but I think there's a reality here that has to be looked at as well.
Sarah Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually sympathize with both of the points that are being made. I have an immense amount of respect for Senator Clausen's experience, and I also feel for the folks who express concern about the racial disparities, particularly within this area of policy. So I guess what I'd ask for is maybe a middle ground. And Mr. Aronson in particular, you outlined that there, you know, there's the one exception for sort of an imminent risk to safety for the students. Maybe the middle ground would be more sort of enumerations around what are the sorts of activities that you're concerned about outside of what Senator Hoffman has already outlined in the bill. And maybe that's a way that the two sides can come together. If you can articulate the other sorts of things that are a grave risk or disruption in the classroom.
I'm going to continue to get feedback from Senators. Senator Kiffmeyer, followed by Senator Johnson.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if...
Yeah, I can
respond. I mean, the answer to the question...
Well, I think it's assumed that Mr. Aronson will work with the author and potential language, but we'll get back to that.
I don't know what the point of having the hearing then is, if we can't...
To get the issues out. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Section 1 is speaking directly to young children, in particular through grade 3. Is the rest of the bill... I've heard high school type of discussions, drivers or so on. Are we on up to third grade? Is that what this is all about, up to third grade, and we're dealing with these things in up to third grade?
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, there's a couple points on here that I'd like to get into, and I would like Dr. Kermes to help aid in this discussion that will probably answer your question and many more that are sitting out there.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to figure out exactly how this, because I just asked a question that wasn't answered. Now we're going to have members that are going to answer or ask questions that are going to be answered. I just want to know what the committee.
Okay. Actually, members, Senator Hoffman, we can go. We're going to have to go into the evening if we go much longer on this bill. We encourage authors to, you know, vet it with others, and I would like to continue to get the feedback from members. You had asked for, to respond on Senator Kiffmeyer on her direct question. But why don't you respond, Senator Kiffmeyer, then we'll get any other members, and then I'll ask what your pleasure is.
And Mr. Chair, I didn't know that it was a longer discussion. It was more of a, is it on up to grades 3 or not, kind of a yes, no. If it's more than that, we don't need to have that discussion. I just...
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the answer is no, it's more. So it's not just K through 3. It's up the line.
Okay.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, there isn't any requirement for parents as I see it in this language. And, you know, 20 years ago you talked about suspension. We talked about suspension when I was in the House. And there was one suggestion that was put forward, never used, but I think it provided some thought, that the parents be required to come and sit in the classroom with the child, so it, that is having problem. Now, I think that's pretty far-fetched, but at least to have the parents be part of the discussion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that's already in there, 125A 575. Look at page 2.24. There it is. It strongly encouraged parent or guardian of the pupil to attend school with the pupil for one day. That happens all the time. So it's there. So thank you for bringing that up.
Senator Dames.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a comment more than a question. I just get concerned. We've seen a lot of legislation come through this year that deals with a lot of these issues. But again, as Senator Kiffmeyer alluded to earlier, we really need to start remembering, too, about the students that are coming there that are well-behaved. Now, I don't care if they're in kindergarten, 1 through 3, whatever that grade or age might be. We need to remember we have a lot of students that are coming well-behaved that want to be challenged. And we need to remember that that's also part of the education process, is challenging everybody, challenging these students too. And in so many cases, I think we just kind of overlooked that. And I don't think that's fair to that group of students.
Senator Hoffman, you have additional testimony?
I would like Dr. Kermes just to go a little deep in the weeds on 2 points, and then I'd like to get this laid over for possible inclusion. And like I said earlier,
Senator Hoffman, it needs to go to judiciary.
Oh, it does go to judiciary. Even before that stop, I said I would work with other people to make sure that we have clean language. So, Dr. Kermes.
Dr. Kermes.
Thank you, Chairman Wigger, Senators. Darren Kermes, the Executive Director of the Southwest Metro Educational Cooperative. Just wanted to address, I think Mr. Aronson and Senator Claussen brought up two very important points with regard to students engaging in dangerous behavior. I don't read the changes to this bill changing that at all, because it allows the ability of a school administrator to address dangerous behavior if it creates imminent harm. So the example of, I would submit that driving through a parking lot with a rebel flag creates danger immediately for the environment. I think that could be addressed right there. Second point that Senator Claussen mentioned, the fire starter who was expelled from another district and now wants to come in, state law already allows the district to use exclusion to prohibit that student from enrolling in. This doesn't change that at all. So I just want to, I don't think that this bill changes those pieces. The question of message to students, it is also in this state a very common event for suspension for truancy. That's not dangerous. And for my entire career, I have wondered why in the world that makes any sense. You tell a kid who doesn't want to be in school, now you don't have to come to school. So this would address that type of behavior. It's not just the dangerous behavior that's in there. I, as an administrator, as a superintendent and a special education director, I called Senator Hoffman. I had some reservations about his original draft. He addressed those. I think this is a very implementable bill, and I think this is great policy for kids. I don't think we need to be suspending 6- and 7-year-olds. I don't believe they are all that dangerous. I think it's a wonderful bill, and I really would encourage you to support it.
Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Denise Dietrich on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I would like to make a couple of comments on behalf of, from the perspective of school board members. We appreciate the goal of the bill and Senator Hoffman's initiative here, and that is to decrease the number of suspensions and expulsions in our public schools, and to use alternative methods instead. But what we would like to do is just also echo the concerns of Senator Claussen and some of those of Mr. Aronson. As I have talked to Senator Hoffman, he is willing to include us in the discussions and to continue discussing the bill and see if we can't differentiate and separate some of these different behaviors and how they mesh with policies and what school board members are doing across the state in order to reduce suspensions and expulsions through their own policy making. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Senator Claussen?
Just one comment. More than one high school principal has found themselves in court trying to defend suspensions based upon what is immediate danger, what constitutes that. So I'd just like to comment. I think the exclusion, the student has to be enrolled before you can exclude.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen. I couldn't hear your last phrase because there's like a rock star concert happening out in the hallway. So could you repeat that?
I may not be up on my total school law, but if I remember correctly, a student has to be enrolled before you can exclude.
Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen, I'd like Dr. Kermes to explain that under the...
Chairman Wigger, Senator Claussen, definition of exclusion in 121A41 says exclusion means an action taken by the school board to prevent the enrollment or re-enrollment. So you expel an enrolled kid, you exclude a kid who's trying to come in. So it's a proactive thing done prior to enrollment. And that's how we would address that example of fire starter.
Thank you, Doc.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify in Senate File 1001? If not, recognizing the author's commitment to continue to work with various stakeholders and others that want to join in, I would suggest that Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 1001 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary.
Interesting. Absolutely. I'm surprised Judiciary, but that's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, motion, I'd like a roll call.
Roll call requested. And further discussion? If not, the roll taken.
Senator Wigger.
Aye.
Senator Bonoff.
Aye.
Senator Chamberlain. Senator Claussen.
No.
Senator Dahl.
Yes.
Senator Dames.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Housley.
Yes.
Senator Jensen.
Yes.
Senator Johnson.
Yes.
Senator Kent.
Yes.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
No.
Senator Nenow. Senator Peterson.
No.
Senator Pratt.
Yes.
Senator Saxog.
Yes.
Senator Stumpf. Senator Torres-Ray.
Yes.
Senator Weber.
No.
Senator Wicklin.
Yes.
12-5.
There being 12 votes in favor, 5 against, the motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Next, we have Senate File 664, Senator Torres-Ray, and... this does have an appropriation, would need to go to finance if referred. So we ask you to bring your testifiers with you and please proceed with Senate File 664.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 664. And members, the idea behind this bill is really to address some issues that have been asked by many of you, and we have had really an opportunity to figure out what is that we need to do in order to really understand how some of our teaching programs actually work and whether or not they are relevant to the needs of the classroom today.
Senator Pearson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just looking for some clarification on how we're going to proceed with conversation on this bill. Are we going to take questions in the middle of the testimony? Are we going to take questions at the end of the testimony? And when the questions are asked, are the members able to get answers for the questions that they put forward and get feedback with the testimony? Yes. I'd just like to know if there's a uniform approach as to how
we'll proceed with the testimony, and then questions may be asked.
And answered?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The idea, again, behind Senate File 664 is that we will have an opportunity to collect information about how these programs work and who are the people who are today pursuing the teaching profession. So through these, if we adopt these policy, we will be able to collect valid data valid, reliable, and timely data for comparing the efficacy of the state's teachers' programs. We will be able to understand who is enrolling in these programs today, who is, in other words, pursuing the teaching profession. We are also going to be able to know more about who are the people in the faculty. We understand today that there are many questions as to how the state is pursuing, really funding, not funding, providing the necessary resources for these programs. And many claim that really our teaching programs are underfunded today. So we want to understand what that means and what is the impact that those the lack of resourcing actually has today in Minnesota. We also will be able to understand what is the time that students need to complete the programs. It seems that some students are able to complete these programs right on time. Others take a tremendous amount of time, and we really don't understand the reasons. Many people claim that, you know, the students are now working, that it's impossible for them to pay tuition. So we need to understand what is happening in terms of completing programs and what are the reasons that create obstacles for students to complete their programs on time. We also would like to know more about who are the students that are being hired after graduation, after they complete their program. You know, are schools that really are preparing our students so well that they immediately find a job, or is there a reputation behind these schools that allow them to pursue a job placement right away? We also need to know the level of readiness to obtain license. You know, some students we know are having tremendous difficulties obtaining license, and we don't know why. Is it that they are prepared, not prepared? Issue talk people are talking about issues around kind of the licensing process actually work. It's not tied to how the students are prepared. So there is a lot of questions around these issues. And Senate File 664 intends to collect that information so that we are able to analyze that information and provide some light into what needs to be done in order to support effective programs. So with me, I have a couple of testifiers that would like to talk about the substantive pieces of these bill, and I would like to welcome them to our
Thank you.
Committee.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And if possible, could I request a page to pass out our handout here? My name is Holly Craigthorpe, and I'm a Minneapolis teacher. I'm currently on a leave of absence, and I've been teaching for 14 years. I'm also the parent of two elementary age, school-age children, and I serve as an advocacy fellow with Educators for Excellence, who I'm representing today. It's a teacher-led organization, and we have 1,000 members who come together to recommend policies. And I have a teacher with me today, Ben McKenzie, who's going to be testifying, who is a member of the policy team to increase teacher diversity. We feel that Senate File 664 will support our goal of strengthening and increasing teacher diversity. Within the next 2 years, the United States Department of Education is going to require states to collect data from teacher preparation programs on the outcomes of their teacher candidates, including the things that are outlined in this bill, graduation, licensure, and employment rates. We think that Minnesota should lead by example in doing this earlier, while also going further by requiring programs to report certain program outcomes disaggregated by race. All teacher preparation programs, whether they're traditional or alternative, should collect and publicly release performance data, including graduation rates, licensure, employment, and satisfaction rates from teacher candidates, as well as their teacher evaluation outcomes. Additionally, we believe that some of these outcomes should be disaggregated by race. Here's why. Historically, we have needed to use racial demographic data to highlight inequities. We need this demographic data disaggregated in order to track gaps in instruction and to address them. Increasing accountability for teacher preparation programs will aid in attracting and supporting teachers of color to join the profession. By publicly releasing accountability data, future teachers will be able to select a program that has a proven track record in preparing teachers of color. All teachers deserve to feel prepared after completing their program. Additionally, this data would allow the Board of Teaching and MDE and the legislature to shine a light on programs that are excelling at preparing teachers from a variety of backgrounds to become licensed and employed. Teacher preparation programs that are increasing teacher diversity in our schools should be recognized, rewarded, and replicated. We need data in order to do that. So we know that there are some privacy concerns here and that the data might be problematic for those reasons, and we definitely support privacy of individual teachers. So in order to protect the privacy of individual teachers and to assure reliable data, we recommend that all teacher preparation programs follow standard practice determined by the National Center for Educational Statistics. That's NCES. The NCES standards are used for all standardized testing in K-12, for example. For all data reported as outlined in the subdivision 4A of this bill, we recommend that teacher preparation programs not publicly report sample cells smaller than 10. That is according to NCES. However, the teacher preparation program could provide a restricted use version that researchers could access for complete information. I fully support Senate File 664 and ready for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'd like to thank you very much for allowing me to testify today on this critical topic. I'm Ben McKenzie, and I have been a high school English teacher at the Fair School in downtown Minneapolis for the last 4 years. And throughout my past 10 years as an educator, I have been proud to partner with motivated and committed colleagues and been grateful for the support of my unions, including Education Minnesota. My training as a teacher began here in Minnesota at St. Olaf College in Northfield. And through the process of becoming a teacher candidate, I learned that we as teachers have the power to engage, inspire, and enrich all of our students. And to do that, I know that we teachers must pursue the goals of informing our students both inside the classroom and within our communities. That's why I joined the Educators for Excellence and their policy team on teacher diversity this last fall, because through this advocacy and through my testimony today, I can support my students during the school day and as a citizen of Minnesota. I'm grateful for the opportunity to discuss this work with other education advocates, including all of the committee members and Senator Torres-Ray in particular, whose efforts in discussing Senate File 664 will be invaluable in supporting teacher preparation accountability and can also support diversifying the teaching force. As our policy team debated and formulated our suggestions to improve teacher diversity, we were stunned to see that Minnesota's teacher preparation programs yield licensure rates and MTLE passing results ranging from 100% to 34%. Understanding how teacher preparation schools work, how effectively they enable student graduation, licensure, employment, and success in the classroom will be vital to encouraging the next generation of teachers. As we strive to close the achievement gap in current Minnesota schools for current students from K to 12, and as we support more diverse students attending MinSCU colleges and universities, we must share information that will help them choose the best schools for them. I want the students I teach today to become the colleagues I collaborate with tomorrow. But this cannot happen if we do not clearly explain what each program offers and allow students to decide which path is right for them. We must have our schools report on the efficacy of their teacher preparation programs, particularly as it reflects the service offered to our teacher candidates of color, to enable the future of teachers in Minnesota to chart their own courses. It is vital that we recognize and reward the programs that work and maintain our high standards for those that do not. As teachers, we can do so much for our students and for one another. We owe to the students we serve today and the colleagues we will welcome tomorrow to support strong and transparent accountability programs for teacher preparation programs. I'd like to thank you all again for allowing me to testify today, and please join me in supporting SF 664.
Thank you very much. Ms. Christ.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Christ. I'm here today on behalf of MACTE, the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, and I do have a handout for committee members if a page could distribute those. While we have some concerns about some of the specifics of this bill, our 31 colleges and universities are no strangers to publicly reporting data about how our programs operate and what they do, how they perform. The handout you're going to get is a very reduced compilation of a 14-page document we handed out in the House, but we're saving some trees and your time by collapsing those into one page. But you can see on that page, in about the lower three-quarters of it, a list of four current data reporting sets that we're already required to submit. We're always glad to provide information and data about our programs to the public, to students, to our teacher, our partners in K-12. I think the key point that I would make right now in response to the testimony to date is that maybe what we need at this point is a little more clarity of purpose for which we would be collecting and reporting this data in order to be clear then about what data is needed. I heard comments about needing to know more about the adequacy of resources to support teacher preparation. I heard questions about the need to increase the diversity of teacher candidates. And I'm not sure the extent to which any of the specific data points listed in this bill might actually help achieve those goals. For example, I looked back again to see about teacher diversity, and I didn't see any the data points here that address that specifically, particularly when many of them are averages. So, you know, when we look at collecting data, and of course there are costs, primarily human resource costs, associated with this, you know, we really need to ask the questions that are listed at the top of this page. Questions, again, like what is the purpose of the data? Legal rights to privacy, that's such an important issue, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Another one is being certain about the degree of reliability and validity of the data, and also how we can fairly report it across all program and licensure options, because those can vary a great deal. Many of them will be very small, and so they might not meet the data threshold, and therefore you might have a very small number of programs reported in a given area, and how useful would that be? I think another point that I would briefly make is that one of the things that we've been very mindful of in discussions about this in the House is that while our programs currently report a great deal of data, so much that that's why in its full list it requires 14 pages, many teacher candidates, for example, don't know how to find that data. Or when they get to the site, they have to wade through an incredible amount of data. I was pleased to see that on the Board of Teaching website, there's really good access to Title II data in ways that are much easier to access than I had thought was the case. But still, a student would need some guidance to be able to find that. They'd need to know how to find the selection where they can pick a particular section and then go directly to that section and then scroll down to find the institution or institutions of interest to them. So I think we would all agree that even though much of the data requested in this bill is currently reported and existed, it's not easily or readily found by many who would have an interest. And that gets me back then to the point about the clarity of purpose here. We've spent a fair amount of time working with a House author in the companion bill in the House. And I know Representative Erdahl's interest is in being able to provide data that students can access when they're making program choices. In that context, we spent some time talking to folks in our colleges and universities, and they identified the kind of key questions that our students ask. You know, they want to know, will I get in, which can speak to things like admissions requirements mm-hmm. and testing requirements. How long will it take me to complete my program? How much will it cost me? How much time will I be able to spend in schools? Will I be able to get a job after I graduate? When and how can I take classes? For example, what online options, evening options, weekend and summer options? So if those are the kinds of questions we want to answer, that would lead us to one set of data. But if there are other questions that we're trying to answer, that would lead us potentially to a different set of data. We have some other points about some specifics of this bill, but I think at this point what I would do is just come back to my initial point, and that is that I think we really need a little more clarity of the purpose of this data collection before we ask our institutions to resubmit in a new format, perhaps data they're already reporting to Title II, to the Board of Teaching through iPads, and collecting for our own database, our Minnesota Teacher Quality Measures database, MTQM. Before the Board of Teaching and the Office of Higher Education would potentially go to the expense of creating a new database, which their IT folks say could cost a great deal of money. I think if we can have a conversation in which we achieve a little better consensus and clarity about what we want to inform people about, to what ends will they be using the data, then I think we could take the list of potential elements, make it something that's manageable for those reporting the data, but reasonable and helpful to those who would be accessing it. And we would love to be a part of the conversation about how to achieve that goal.
Thank you, Ms. Christ. Mr. Bartholomew? Okay, perhaps if there's time, we'll receive his testimony. Is there anyone else that'd like to testify? And we'll open up for questions. Yes, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erin Doan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Teaching. I just want to really, I'll be brief and just echo Ms. Chris's sentiment in that many of the things that the Board of Teaching collects right now and the data that we're using are not among the items on the list, but there are many items on the list that are things we don't have the capacity at this moment in time to collect. I just want to speak to the price tag issue because I know that's one that people always stumble over. And no, we don't have the system that would be ready in time to collect all of this data, to be able to analyze it, to put it together in a report that would be out by June 1st of next year. So when you see fiscal note information, please know that it's partly that expedited timeline, and it's also the implementation of IT resources that we really don't have right now. All that said, I think that we do have data on file that is helpful, and certainly the board is interested and willing to engage in conversation to say, how can we partner with the Office of Higher Education to be able to put something together? They've been willing to host information on their website, so I think more conversation will lead us to a place where even if we don't get to that full list of qualifications, we have information that's helpful and would be ready to put it out there and work together to do so in an expedited manner.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe not questions, but I, too, have concerns for all the reasons that have been mentioned by the Board of Teaching and MACTE. I'm not convinced that the background and the rationale necessarily are an impetus for us to go forward with something like this. And I really don't know what other profession asks for this kind of data in terms of their teacher or training. And so forth. So I'm concerned also about the cost, et cetera. So I think I'm just reiterating some of the points that were made by some of the testifiers. Thanks.
Another comment, question, Senator Claussen, followed by Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking over the handout that you've provided, and it talks about within the next 2 years, the U.S. Department of Education will require states to collect data from teacher preparation programs. And it seems to me that they will provide pretty extensive requirements about what they're looking for. And rather than us start a program and then maybe have to add or maybe look at the cost and conform with U.S. Department of Education, it might be something that we want to delay until we see the federal requirements, which apparently are going to be coming out rather soon. So just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and again, probably a comment only, but my concern is in our previous hearing where we heard about the urgent need for teachers in our state, and I'm wondering if that factor is considered as you're looking at the teacher preparation programming, because that is my concern, is how are the teacher colleges that prepare our teachers, how are they doing? And if I'm afraid we're going to get lower quality teachers and lower standards in order to meet the need that we have. Is that considered at all? And if so, if this goes forward, I hope you would address that.
Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think this is a good idea. Timing seems to be the issue. Cost seems to be the issue. But this seems rather straightforward and obvious that we should be doing this. We should know this because this is where the teachers come for our students. So when we talk about teacher evaluations, other kinds of issues, this is probably one of the most important places to start. My question is, if you have that data, some of these data points already, if you already have them, could that be given to the committee, and how soon might that be available? It would be good to know what that already is.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, at this point, the data system that we are using is about a year and a half into its first round of being used. We do not, at this point, have the ability to aggregate that data and are looking for that to be coming with further upgrades to our system. But certainly there are other reports as far as testing or other things that we would normally issue as reports to the legislature that we can make sure that you have in hand if necessary.
Senator Bonoff and Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, and with regard to the data and the gathering of that, I suspect that OHG can be of assistance in that. And yesterday in higher ed, we heard from the Bush Foundation, who is, as Senator Torres-Ray found out, has already spent $30 million to do some of and get at what this bill is attempting to do. And so we know it's not inexpensive, this effort, but we also know that there has been work that's gone on prior to this that would make this easier. So I'm hopeful that it, you know, with regard to timing, that has to be worked out, but these are certainly important things that we need to know.
Senator Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, I think I would echo some of the concern that Ms. Chris had pointed out with regard to the purpose. She had pointed out a number of things with regard to efficacy that I actually don't think are getting at the heart of the matter. I mean, you could look at that efficacy in a way that says, well, if we're just graduating a bunch of kids on time and it's efficient in that sense, you know, maybe cost or something like that. What I think is the goal is that efficacy really and should be a consideration of their effectiveness or their impact on student achievement. Mm-hmm. And so what I don't see is I see a bunch of things that you could use to maybe measure that, but I don't see that as an express purpose in the bill. And that's the only thing that I personally care about. I mean, all the other things are secondary in importance to the impact that the teacher is actually having once they are certified. I fully support what you're trying to do, and I think there's other organizations that would attest to the fact that teacher prep is a very important part of the mix, the National Council on Teacher Quality and others. So I think you could be clearer about what the actual goal is and what, you know, what rating of efficacy is actually important, because I think there's different ways you could look at it, and I would hope that it's a student-centric viewpoint. So that's all I have. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Pearson, I know that Senator Torres-Ray has been taking careful notes. I sense there's a strong commitment to work and be responsive to a number of the excellent suggestions. A fiscal note is in progress, and we would all meet again as a finance committee to see potential new language as well as the financial impact. Mr. Bartholomew did arrive. His body language says it's all been said. And so we'll entertain a motion if we're ready for Senator Torres-Ray to move that Senate File 664 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance. Further discussion? Not all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, and all your testifiers. We'll get to two more bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr.
Senate File 106, which Senator Bonoff will ask your testifiers to join you. And then we'll go to Senator Kiffmeyer as soon as she's done, and
I think we can do the next one within 3 to 5 minutes. And the remaining bills will be taken up at 6 o'clock this evening. Senator Bonoff, Senate File 106, World Languages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to be here with our superintendent of Hopkins School District, John Schultz, Diane Schimmel. Benig. That's a tough one. The director of teaching, learning, and assessment from Hopkins Schools. So I will let them really talk about the bill in the interest of time. But just in summary, members, what this bill is about is allowing the school district to have the flexibility to take their students who have become very, very fluent in another language, have the opportunity to continue with that language in ninth grade. The way the law currently is that if they're in a position to take, you know, an accelerated language course, they have to stand in line behind a junior or senior. And we all know what happens when you don't, when you have a break in learning a language. So
thank you, Sarah Bonoff. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for considering this bill. It is an important bill, as we in Hopkins and I think across the state are seeing a change in demographics. We have students that are coming from different cultures and learning different languages and learning them quickly. And we really support immersion programs. And we are hoping that as these students progress in their language, that they get access as well as challenges in languages in the advanced classes, such as PSEO, College in the Schools, and other sorts of university classes. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our Director of Teaching and Learning, who works with this every day and is on the ground working on this, Dr. Diane Schimmelfennig.
Good morning, Mr.
Welcome,
Chair.
Welcome, Dr. Diane.
Thank you so much.
Smart, Mr. Chair.
That works, too. Briefly, what we're hoping to do, we've developed a Spanish immersion program at the secondary level, which serves students in 7 and eventually will go through grade 12. And the student community it serves is about 50% heritage learners of Spanish and about 50% students that have completed an elementary Spanish immersion program. And so we're wanting, as Dr. Schultz and Senator Bonoff mentioned, we're wanting a more diverse student body to be able to access college-level courses when they're ready to. So we're asking for you to create flexibility in the statute so that students who are qualified can take college in the schools courses in grades 9 or 10.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Is there any audience that would like to testify on Senate File 106?
No, this is good.
Senator Claussen.
Just a point. This is also in my concurrent enrollment bill. Same language. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, that's great. Thank you.
Right. So we're on a roll. Senator Bonoff, would you like to make a motion?
I would, although I assume the motion is just to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. So I move that Senate File 106 be laid over and considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On that motion, further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. Adopted. Thank you very much,
Bonoff,
and testifiers. Senator Kiffmeyer, Senate File 979, and you have several testifiers. We ask them to join you as you would like. Maybe there's an outside chance we could get to 961. Not as likely, but hang in there just in case. Senator Kiffmeyer, and as everyone's approaching, I believe Senator Claussen does have a delete all for 559, and if there's a way that can be aid. Available. Yes. Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill, Senate File 979, has to do with the ability of student surveys. I don't think we realize today, we talked about student testing, the number of testing. Well, add on top of that, you have local testing, classroom testing. But in addition, we're having these surveys come through. Very intrusive surveys asking very personal questions. And so parents around the state are having great concern. There are supposed to be some opportunities to for parental involvement in regard to this, but we do not feel that this is strong enough. And again, this is not in regards to educational testing. This is in regard to intruding upon asking personal questions and the use of that data. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would rather have my testifiers proceed and to be able to explain. Our first one is Autumn Leva, and she'll introduce herself.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, and welcome.
Good morning, Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for taking some time with us today. I know there's a lot of bills on the schedule. I am the policy director for Minnesota Family Council, and we represent tens of thousands of Minnesota families and churches around the state. And we're here today in support of SF 979 as an extremely practical and common sense initiative that addresses a very real problem in our schools, actually. I just want to echo what Senator Kiffmeyer said and reassure you that these types of questions in student surveys, school-initiated surveys, actually do occur regularly in districts across the state. I'm the newest full-time employee with the Minnesota Family Council, so I was asking some of my longtime colleagues about this issue when this came up, and they concurred and reassured me that, yes, we get phone calls every single school year with parents who are upset about these surveys and basically just all saying the same thing. They wanted the opportunity to know in advance that these types of questions were going to be asked of their child. And due to short testimony today, I'll stick to two brief points as to why this is a good initiative. And the first is this bill is one simple way to advance the protection of student and family privacy. You'll notice that some of the categories that would require parental notification in this bill include the students and even the families, sexual behavior, religious beliefs, political beliefs, and even income. And for many families, this type of information may be considered extremely private. For instance, most students do not have an income, so obviously the student would be asked about the family's income. And many parents may not wish this to be known, or at least given the reason for which this information is requested and to whom and where that data will go. And for other families, they may prefer not to disclose religious and political beliefs for a variety of reasons. Some of them may be religious in nature. And for other families, whether or not they approve of their child being sexually active or anything along those lines, they may prefer that sexual behavior may not be discussed or should not be discussed as more of a private matter. And the bottom line is, even if a parent really has no problem with their child answering questions regarding sensitive matters, parents do still have a right to know for data privacy reasons. They have a right to know who's collecting data on them, on their family, on their child, and for what purpose the data will be used. And these basic data privacy protections are afforded adults when they submit questionnaires for a variety of purposes. They should certainly be extended to minors and their families within the context of the school district. And finally, I think the practical benefits of this bill are also very important. Many of the survey questions requiring parental consent under this bill highlight important issues for parents. For example, these surveys may be asking about whether a student's been bullied at school and the nature of that bullying, asking specific questions to help the student understand if they have or have not been bullied, or whether or not a student is experiencing feelings or behaviors of depression. And I'm sure many of y'all, if you have children, or I know I gave my parents these answers to the standard, you know, how was your day? How are you feeling? How's school? And my answers were often, you know, fine, good. These types of surveys can highlight the types of questions or issues that parents could really be asking their children and looking for specific responses to gauge how their student really is doing, more than just the typical fine or okay. So parents should have the ability to review these surveys so that they can have those types of conversations with their child before the student fills out that survey. And so for practical common sense and data privacy reasons, we urge this committee to move SF 979 forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my second testifier is Barb Anderson.
I do have a handout here if there is a page that could distribute these.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barb Anderson. I am a former high school teacher, a parent, and a grandparent, and I am speaking in support of Senate File 979. After 24 years of researching sex education curricula, sex education surveys, and questionnaires given to school-age youth, I have watched the progression of these surveys becoming more and more explicit in their sexual content and exposing children to aberrant sexual behavior simply by the choices that they offer students in some of these survey questions. One survey that was administered in my school district offered 12 genders for students to choose from in order to classify themselves. There are questions about religious views and personal beliefs regarding sexual activity. When I took the diversity training program for teachers, we were encouraged to use a survey in the classroom to spark discussion with students called Homophobia 101, a heterosexual questionnaire, and you are getting a copy of that questionnaire right now. This is similar to one that was given to health teachers as a resource to use in the classroom at the Minnesota School Health Education Conference that I attended a few years ago. And I believe you had one of those, a copy of that given earlier as well.
Oh my God.
Well, this outlandish survey turns morality on its head. I'll just read one question, number 6. If you have never slept with a person of the same sex, how do you know that you wouldn't prefer that? These kinds of questions encourage sexual experimentation. The message students receive when it is delivered with the authority of the school district is clear. Forget what your mother or father taught you about sexuality. Just do whatever feels good to you. Once this is presented to a student by an authority figure in the classroom, it is difficult to unteach it, especially when parents have not given permission for their child to take a survey like this or are unaware that this has even taken place. They are thereby unable to correct misinformation or deal with the confusion. Senate File 979 is a common sense bill that will uphold parental rights and will protect the minds of minor children in the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
And our next testifier, Mr. Chairman, is Twyla Braze.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we do a lot of work on the privacy issue, protecting individuals for privacy rights, protecting their consent rights, et cetera. So regarding Senate File 979, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I think there are a few basic principles of privacy that are at stake that this bill addresses. Namely, number one, a requirement for consent acknowledges the right of the individual, the parent, to make a choice, to be free from coercion and unwanted data collection. So choice being one of the principles. Number two, requiring consent in the school setting acknowledges the power structure between the student and the teacher, and that the student is still a child under the protection of his or her family. In short, the child is a vulnerable individual and can be taken advantage of in the school setting because of the power difference and the hope of a good grade. Number three, the child is not and should not be made into an instrument for data collection, analysis, and research on the child or on the child's family. Such activities need the parents' informed written consent. The fourth principle, the school district is an arm of the government. The consent requirement acts in place of, sort of, a Tennyson warning, telling parents that they do not have to submit to data collection and use activities, giving them the option, giving them the choice. And number five, the school is a place, the school is a place where children are taught, not where they are caught in difficult situations that they don't know how to get themselves out of. Not where they are forced to reveal their private lives or their private thoughts of them or their family for permanent records, data collection, and analysis. Therefore, we support Senate File 979 to protect the children, to protect their parents, to protect the family, and to require consent. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, my next testifier is Mr. Chris Kaufman, who will introduce himself.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm a first-time testifier, so I wrote it all down.
That's okay. A good thing.
I am a parent of three children, school-age children, and I'm here to speak in favor of SF 979. As a parent of three school-age children, it is my role to be the protector of my children's and my family's personal information. By passing this bill, you will put parents and guardians in control of when personal information is asked for and given in schools and will prevent my children from disclosing information which may not be in their best interest. Having recently been subject to fraudulent bank access, I am painfully aware of the negative impact access information may have. It makes sense that parents have the final say on what information their children are asked at school. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two other testifiers today, and they'll introduce themselves.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Carrie Ann. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am here as a parent to testify in support of Senate 979, requiring parental consent for student surveys. I'm a lifelong resident of Minneapolis. I have a second grader in a public charter school. And I also want to express the nonpartisan nature of this bill, as I fall on the opposite side of the spectrum, and I still completely agree with this. I'm nonpartisan, I'm atheist, and I'm sapiosexual. I'm very much not heterosexual. I actually have no problem with these surveys based on religious beliefs, and I have no problem with them with having basic sex ed for youth. Although my child has not begun yet taking these surveys in school, I'm very concerned with the wide-scale collection of extremely personal information that is linked to a student's personal ID number. Because of the significant weakening of the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, the FERPA regulations that occurred in 2011, there are many people who now have access to students' sensitive, individually identifiable information, including psychological data, without parental consent. Besides providing no benefit whatsoever to the children's education, this data has no right being in the hands of third-party corporations for private gain. I'm especially concerned given that Pearson, a major player in the standardized testing and survey business, as of August 2013, now owns a for-profit behavioral company called Biobehavioral Diagnostics Company, profiting off of increased diagnoses of ADHD and other psychiatric diagnoses and inventions. Besides it being inappropriate for third parties to collect this information, once it has been collected, it's extremely vulnerable to identity theft. Schools do not have military-grade computer security, nor should they need to. The best way to avoid the collection of this is to prevent, or the risk of theft is to prevent the collection in the first place. At the very least, if these surveys are going to be permitted, then I am definitely in full support of parental notice and consent prior to their administration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am here to testify in support also of Senate File 979. My name is Linda Bell, and I am a former public school teacher, wrote state standards for the Florida Department of Education, and am also a parent of two children. Speaking as a teacher, schools and kids are near and dear to my heart. As I talk to my teacher friends from my former school district in Robbinsdale and those I know in Minneapolis, there are great concerns about these surveys and their proliferation. We know there are 1 to 4 surveys given in any week of the school year, going across the entire year, which leads to a reduction in classroom learning time. The adage that teachers need to have time to teach is never more true than today. We are aware that sometimes parents are not being notified in advance of the surveys. The biggest merit of this bill is that there is a notification clause stating that parents must be notified prior to the instrument being administered, and particularly the use of the language informed written consent. Lastly, I do take exception to the amount of data being collected and stored on children through these surveys. Whether intrusive or benign, the questions are not one that I would ask an acquaintance or someone that I do not know. And also, surveys may be inappropriate for various ages as all children mature at different rates. And so I wonder, why are we asking our children these questions? And where is that information going? Children's personal, private thoughts and feelings stored in a data warehouse for others to possibly purchase. And then we have the data breaches, which we have seen in our own state over the last few years, either within corporate entities or within school districts. And yesterday, or perhaps the day before, we heard nationally with this latest huge data breach within Anthem, where tens of millions of children had their personal social security numbers, names, and addresses stolen. And now these children are targets for identity theft. And so I urge you to vote in favor of Senate File 979, giving the notification of prior written informed consent to parents on school surveys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. I believe there's some that may not be listed on the agenda that want to testify, but if you're on the agenda, you would go first. So, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am here to testify in support of Senate File 979. My name is Ann Taylor, and I am the mother of both a high schooler and a toddler. My journey with school surveys began shortly after experiencing a school data breach in my district. Twice, as a matter of fact. That experience taught me to take the extra time to review every piece of paper or electronic disclosure that comes my way. With the increase in technology use among students in our state and across the nation, it is also one that has created a lack of privacy for our children in 21st century learning. I first heard of surveys taking place in our school in the year of 2013 when my district decided to use a local nationally recognized company called Search Institute. I was informed by my district in an email that I had to sign a form to opt out of a survey and had to physically come into the school to view it, and within a very limited time. It seems rather peculiar to me that a parent would be instructed to visit a school to view a survey in the classroom by wasting more classroom time by administering these surveys, asking an array of intrusive personal questions about themselves and their family, and all the while logging on using their school ID code, which links up to their personal family information. There has been an increase in surveys, some of which I as a parent cannot access because the system in some school districts will only allow access by using a Google account. One example of a survey I was not able to access was dubbed a yearbook survey, created and posted by a student and posted on the school website. Upon viewing it, the survey was actually a transportation questionnaire, asking things like what kind of car the student drives, where they park, noting specific locations within the school building, identifying who has the worst road rage, a description of bumper stickers on the car, if any, and if the student has an out-of-state license plate. Surveys that I have not been informed about, nor have given permission to in my district, have been the following, and I'll name just a few. Matchematics, a fundraiser compatibility questionnaire that asks for students' name, birth date, height, and hair color. 16 personalities, a personality questionnaire that mimics Myers-Briggs psychological testing. EducationPlanner.org, a website that includes questions to decide if the student is an audio, visual, or tactile learner. A Schoology student profile, this is a parent-student portal system, asking the student who they live with, their family living arrangements, commitments outside of the school, types of social media used, and personality types.
We're going to have to recess within about one more minute.
No problem. Thank you. What concerns me is the growing data that is out there where a child and their family information is not being protected. It is a violation of their own right to privacy, and as a parent, should I not be concerned that this data is being lightly tossed around on the web? What would third parties have by investing in our children, and under what legal authority should we be concerned that our child's privacy is being tracked? I would ask, because of these experiences, fully support 979. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we need to go up for session, so we are going to recess until 6 p.m., and then we'll continue with testimony and additional business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Recess. Thank you.